afternoon, and welcome to Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the heartland of Santa Cruz. It's that time of the week, and I'm Janaea, and I'm going to be with you, your host, from 2 until 5 today. And with actually, this is Janaea Live. That was a recording. I just arrived, and you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. And we're always looking for donations, and they can be mailed to FRSC P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz 95061. And with me co-hosting is Karuna. You want to just say hi, Karuna?
Hey, everybody.
We have quite a program lined up. For the first hour, we're going to be speaking with Saring Wamong. And her family, she's from the San Francisco Bay Area, and her family is from the region of the area where the earthquake happened in Tibet about 2.5 weeks ago. And she's going to be talking about the rescue effort and the people that live there and what their situation is presently. And then the second hour from 3 to 4, we're going to be speaking with Russ Baker, and he is the author of Family of Secrets. That's about the Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. And then from 4 to 5, we're going to be speaking with those that are putting on a conference earlier next month on understanding deep democracy. But I have Saring on the phone right now, and I'd like to put her on. Saring, are you with us?
Yes.
Oh, hi. Welcome to Free Radio.
Thank you.
I'm so honored that you've taken the time to be with us. Truly, and with me is Karuna.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you. And I really want to say I'm sorry deeply from my heart what's happened to your family and friends in Tibet, the earthquake. And we'll be talking about that. And before we get started, Karuna has something she'd like to read.
Yeah. So this is just a short prayer. It's called the short Tashi Sikpa prayer that makes victorious any activity. So I like to read it at the beginning of our show today, and I'll read it once in Tibetan and once in English. Om Nam Sa Tashi Zingi Lanam La Gyupe Chak Sa Tse We Je Zung Te Don Ni Lun Ju Tashi Me Zung Jing Ge Lek Pen De Pa Gi Pun Tsum Sok Tak Tu Mi Ju Jang Ju Jong Shing Ge Ju Tun Tsam Pa Ma Lu Ju Pa Shok. Om, to the marvelous, auspicious, heavenly deities, I bow down. Please accept me and bless me so that I may spontaneously realize supreme good fortune to benefit myself and others. Possessing sublime wealth, bliss, and glory, always cultivating the enduring tree of bodhicitta, may we accomplish all supreme and ordinary wishes. And I say this for the Tibetan people.
Thank you, Karuna. It was beautiful.
Sure.
Hi, Saring.
Hello.
And you had emailed to me some information about your relatives that are there and their present circumstances. And just the if you could share a little bit about that, what you've heard recently, and then the history of the people.
Certainly. The town of Jeju, which is the town that has suffered most from the earthquake.
And that's in eastern Tibet?
And this is in eastern Tibet, which traditionally we call Kham. Kham is the region of eastern Tibet.
Kham.
And Jekundo, or Jeju, is one of the main trading towns of this particular region. Most of my family members live there. I have probably 15 first cousins, and then, you know, they probably have 15 kids between them.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them have lost homes. But as my aunt was saying yesterday, you know, 90% of the people in town have lost homes. So they're all in the same situation right now. Almost all of them sleep outside. I think they're nervous to sleep inside their homes, if some of the homes are standing. So they're all staying in tents, either in the yard or they're all staying in a big field on the outskirts of town. You know, water is a problem. There's no electricity at the moment. So I think it's a very difficult time, of course, for them. And it's only the beginning. You know, it will continue for a long time.
It will. And what is the rescue effort of the Chinese government, or are any NGOs allowed to come in, or outside help?
I think in this situation, the Chinese government has been doing their best. My family members say that people are getting fed. You know, they have water. The people who are in the camps are taken care of. They've been distributing tents. I think they still don't have sufficient tents, but they feel like the government has done their best. The government has also permitted a few international aid agencies to enter and work, which I think is a little different from the previous earthquake in Sichuan, where I think not many people were permitted to come in from the outside. And Tibetans from other regions have been extremely helpful. A lot of monasteries from very distant places have brought in truckloads of butter and sampa, and monks have been there helping every day. So I think everyone feels great solidarity with the people in Jeku. Especially the Tibetans in Tibet.
Well, that's good news.
Yeah.
And I know that when I first heard the news, I just learned that it was in China, and I had no idea that it was actually Tibet. Can you say a little bit about that? Who was it? Hillary Clinton, I heard, was saying her apologies were for the Chinese people.
Yes, and that's, we Tibetans are sensitive to that, as you can imagine, and I was very disturbed because I had close friends who are well-read and quite, involved with the world, and they had no idea it was happening in Tibet and in my region, so they were very upset because, they had been reading the papers, and most of the major newspapers ran the story of the earthquake on April 14th, and the headlines were all, Western China.
Mm-hmm.
And, and the region was sometimes referred to as bordering Tibet, or the Tibetans were referred to as ethnic Tibetans. So I think there was great confusion in terms of where exactly this area was and who the people were that were impacted. So for us Tibetans, it is very upsetting, and some Tibetans also were not aware that this region was in Tibet.
No, not at all. And I believe that is being corrected somewhat now, but still.
Yes, I think now most papers, if they mention the earthquake, they do mention Tibetans much more clearly.
Seringla, this is Karuna, and I just want to let you know myself also, I've been connected with the Tibetans for over 20 years when I lived in New Mexico and here. And so it really touches my heart deeply. I did not realize this China earthquake was Tibet myself until I started getting the emails from various Dharma groups in Northern California and Southern California, pulling together Sangha to come and say prayers specifically for this community of Tibetans in Kham. So I want you to just know that there has been this pulling together, and I thought, oh, okay, it is Tibet. It's our Tibetan friends who are suffering over here, though we don't want anybody to suffer, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
of course. So.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that is true, suffering is suffering, and it should not matter whether it's the Chinese suffering or whether it's the Tibetan suffering, but we would at least like to know that, you know, these are Tibetans.
Sure,
and that
to
I'm
be
sure
recognized.
The Tibetans who are dying would like to be known as Tibetans.
Yes,
and
of
have
course.
Their names acknowledged, too.
Yeah.
And before we go on, I just want to apologize for not giving you an official introduction. I just want to say a little bit about Tsering. And how do you pronounce your name, Wangmo?
Tsering Wangmo Dompa.
Wangmo Dompa. Sorry. You were raised in India and Nepal, and you're actually an author in your own right. You wrote Rules of the House and In the Absent Every Day and Recurring Gestures, and you're presently a member of the Tibetan Association of Northern California. And for 10 years, you worked with, I believe, a relief organization. Is that correct?
Yes.
Great. So you really know what is involved here. It hit home. Yes. And can you say a little bit about the history of the people from that region?
Certainly. The people of Jeku are known as Gawas. And they're part of the region of Kham. And Kham, which is in eastern Tibet, is traditionally, you know, has always been known for being fiercely independent as people. And most of the area is a nomadic area. So they herd yaks and they herd sheep and move around the land maybe like 3-4 times a year. And right now, probably majority of the community still live as herders in and around Jeku. Jeku itself is a little unique because it was a farming area as well as a herding community. So in that way, you know, they became sort of the nexus of trade in that region. It's a very, you know, I've been there 4-5 times and stayed for 4-5 months because I have family there. And I have always loved the sort of strong sense of Tibetan identity and and just this, you know, vitality in the area. People speak the dialect, and the dialects are very different from region to region. And people still speak the dialect there. Which is, you know, always wonderful.
I know in the email that you sent to me, you said the young as well as the elderly know their dialect. It is a town where people end their conversations with traditional blessings. That sounds so rich. You know, and it's probably helping them maintain themselves, and they have something to draw upon presently.
Yes, I'm sure.
Have you been speaking directly with your relatives?
Yes, I call them every other night, or, you know, every night. It depends on who I get through to. You know, I don't necessarily get through every time. They don't have electricity, so, you know, some of them can't get their cell phones charged.
Oh, right.
So some of them, you know, have... have jobs, so they go to their offices, and then they do have, I think, several units set up, so they can charge cell phones. So I speak to my aunt, and I speak to my cousins, and, you know, my aunt is sitting, most of the time these days, she's either sitting in the yard, where they have a small tent, because the house has collapsed. So she'll tell me stories about what's going on in the neighborhood, and, you know, about the street, and, you know, what she can see now, because everything has collapsed around in her neighborhood.
And Tsering, staying in the yard and in a tent, what is the weather like there? Up until summer, I think it must be really cold in Tibet. Is this the same in the Kham region?
Yes, it is. You know, day before yesterday when I spoke to her, she said there was a very severe dust storm. She said she just couldn't see much, you know, it was just very thick and strong. A few days prior to that, it had been raining, so you know, I was saying maybe, you know, the dust storm is easier than the rain, and she was saying no, you know, the rain is easier just because it clears up and but it's getting warmer, she said, so the nights are still cold.
Yeah.
And it's hard, you know, when they're sleeping outside, it gets very cold at night, but if the sun is out during the day, then, you know, it's pleasant, it's not so cold.
Sure, and the Tibetans are very sturdy people of heart and as of body. But,
yes,
you know, I must imagine that their need for things like blankets and tents, you know.
Food, water.
More food.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I think, you know, Mount was saying that a lot of people don't have tents yet.
Mm.
So there's still some people without tents. And so, you know, she, when I ask her how she is, she always says, oh, I'm fine, I have a tent,
right.
I have blankets, and, you know, and she was saying, everybody's in the same situation, so, you know, they don't, you know, they don't feel they're suffering so heavily, I think, because they look around and everybody is in the same situation.
Yes, and that doesn't diminish the dire situation that it is.
Not at all, not at all. But personally, I think it just helps them sort of, you know,
cope.
Continue, you know.
Yeah.
There's not much else they can do.
Right, of course. That's one of the beautiful thing about your people. Is, like I said, their very strong heart and their persevering compassion,
mm-hmm.
you know, and not wanting to harm anybody else and walking with the hardships peacefully.
Yeah.
And they are allowing other monks in from outside of the region. To bring food.
That was my, you know, that was what I heard. But then I've been reading in the newspapers that the monks have been asked to leave, and, you know, some of it could be just because of practical reasons, you know, the town.
For their safety?
Probably can't contain so many people. So, you know, I don't know what the real, the truth is there.
You know, what's credible?
I think, you know, they're still, monks helping.
Mm-hmm. It would be wonderful, a real open heart on part of the Chinese government demonstrating that if they would allow the Dalai Lama to come back.
Oh, yes. I mean, it would mean a great deal to, you know, the people who've lost families. And every other family in town has lost family members. Some people have lost, you know, everyone in their family. You know, I am very grateful because I have not lost any immediate family members. Some of them have broken their legs and hands, but nothing, you know, nothing fatal.
Sering, do you know, with all the injuries that have happened, is there medical care now, or is there medical care coming in? I know I saw one picture on the website with the man holding his daughter and his face was all bloody. And
mm-hmm.
just wondering what kind of assistance they currently have and what kind of assistance is needed if we have resources we can put out there so that people may contribute. Maybe that wants to happen at the end. But if you could tell us what's happening now, that would be really interesting.
Any hospitals in the area or may still be standing? Or
yeah, the hospitals have been damaged, but they have, you know, they have tents that have been set up in the fields where the people live, and as well as in, you know, some of the hospital areas are still standing, so they are functioning. The first few days, and I think they're still doing that now, they were airlifting the more serious patients to, you know, other towns in China. So a lot of the patients were taken away and provided care in other cities and towns, which, you know, took the pressure off from having to tend to them in Jeju, where they didn't have many facilities because a lot of the equipment have been also destroyed.
Destroyed, right. I saw that they were taking people to Chengdu, to the hospital there.
Yeah.
And then is it Yushu?
True.
There's a service group or a relief center in Yushu or Yushi?
Well, Jeju is, Jeju's Chinese name is Yushu, so it's the same.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so there are local doctors and local nurses. In fact, I have 3-4 family members who are doctors, and I have not been able to get through to them because they are, I think, just working, you know, endless hours.
Extremely busy.
Yeah. But most other patients have been taken to Chengdu, to Xining, to Lanzhou, and to, neighboring cities. So, I think that there is help there. I'm not sure about, volunteers or if that's been happening there. I know a lot of Chinese doctors and other physicians had come, I think, from mainland China. That was what I was told when I first called. A lot of volunteers had come from China to Chengdu to help. And they're still looking for survivors under the buildings. Although I think people have lost hope now of finding anyone alive, they're still searching, I think.
Yeah, is Dapa a region near there, or what area of Tibet is Dapa?
How is that so?
D-A-P-A?
D-A-P-A. I would not be able to tell.
Okay.
I don't recognize the...
The reason I ask is because looking on the links on one of the sites that you had recommended, the Tibetan Village Project, there's something called Conscious Journeys, and there's a medical mission to Tibet.
Mm-hmm.
And there are volunteers coming who have medical background. I think they have 4 people so far. They're looking for 8 altogether, and I was wondering if that was connected to actually Chengdu.
Oh.
And, or if something like that similarly could be set up to bring more assistance in for your people in this direct area.
Yeah, I don't know of of medical teams going there, and I don't know if they will be allowed. That's also a possibility that they may not be allowed. I've heard some local people say that it's more beneficial if established health workers or experienced doctors go to the towns where the people are being treated. In the cities of
right, like the Kishan,
in the hospitals.
Uh-huh.
It's hard to say right now. I'm sure that they have great need for, equipment and medicine and, those kind of things. I'm sure that that would be useful. But, I have no idea who's coordinating and... what role, UNICEF or Red Cross or those large organizations are playing.
And I went to the Tibetan Association of Northern California's website, and they recommended specific groups to donate to the Tibet Quake Relief Fund, and one was Snowland Services Group. And their website is wiseearth.org. And then Rokpa, is that the correct place?
Rokpa.
R-O-K-P-A.
Rokpa.
R-O-K-P-A.org also.
The thing is, I think some of these contributions are going through Tibet, but we don't know exactly maybe where they were going. So if there are any... I don't know, do you have anything
these
specific
were both recommended.
With the Tibetan community in the Bay Area, Sering, where... PayPal account, or do you recommend also going through the links on the websites that you recommended, the Tibetan Village Project?
I think, Tibetan Village Project, Machik, M-A-C-H-I-K,
M-A-C-H-I-K.
And then Jinpa, J-I-N-P-A .org.
Okay.
These groups all have local roots. They are already in the field and they're already working. Magic and Tibetan Village Project and a couple of other organizations are working together. They formed a coalition. So their work is very reliable and they've
right.
already started getting aid. So they're, you can rely on them as well as Jinpa. It's a local organization. They're based there. You can also go on the website for Tibetan Association of Northern California, which is www.tank.org, and they'll have links to these organizations, and people can just look through and make their own choice.
And you can just click on Tibet Quake Relief Fund there on their website, TANC. You can just Google, actually, TANC, and it will come up.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
that easy, folks.
Yeah. I mean, I think at this point, you know, money is the only way we can help them,
I know.
You know, get what they want. And I think it's so important to remember that this is just the beginning, and it's going to take a long, long time to rebuild the whole town.
Yes.
You know, it's going to take a long time.
And that's something I'd like to address, too, what the future looks like in terms of rehabilitating the town. What is going to be the Chinese influence? Do you have any idea? Or have you thought about that, how it may change the character of the town? I know that your people were nomadic, and some have been forced to move into structures in the city, and it's changed their whole way of life, no doubt. And I wonder what the future holds now in terms of who's going to have a say in how it's resurrected.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know what the plans for the reconstruction are. You know, my guess is that it's probably too early for them to be talking about that, because they have yet to clean the town. You know, I was asking my aunt, when are you going to rebuild? And she just laughed. She said, oh, it's going to take a long time because we haven't even cleared the place, you know. So I think, I'm sure at some level people are sitting down and mapping it out, but I think for people who live there, it's too early to say anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's important for us as a community to remember and keep an eye and bring up these questions, so that when the town is rebuilt, you know, that the Chinese government are accountable, and that they will keep in mind the history and culture of the place when they are rebuilding. And I hope
it's
that,
so
you know, that will be the guide.
Yes. And you said at one point that it was a nexus of trade. So it must have been a very important area in Tibet.
It was for that particular region. You know, Cheku was the center of several nomadic communities. And these are very sort of isolated nomadic communities. My family is from a particular region called Dompa, which in the old days was probably, you know, a week or 2 weeks journey from Cheku by horseback. So people would come to Cheku with their butter and with their with the products that they had from their herd, and then exchange it with the traders in town for white flour and, you know, maybe, I don't know, fabric. Maybe guns, whatever they could buy, you know, in exchange. So there was a lot of bartering that went on, and Cheku was the center. So a lot of tribes, clans, nomadic clans and tribes that lived in that area all came down to Cheku for their trading and to get, you know, things that they didn't have in their land.
And I love what you wrote to me. You said, these are territories designed with geographical cunning of such formidable rivers, mountains, belligerent kingdoms, and chieftains that for much of its history it managed to eschew a fixed political or administrative center. They must have been very fierce people,
yeah.
Fiercely independent. And
yeah.
That doesn't die away in
yeah.
last year. Yeah. Do you want to say a little bit about that?
Central Tibetans are always fearful of us Easterners. You know, I mean,
I didn't know that.
They think we're just ill-tempered and, you know, ready to spring into a fight, which we probably are, you know. In fact, even when, you know, in the past, when Hendrik Harrier was going to come, he was warned by people saying, oh, you know, people would just get that look of terror in their eyes when they spoke about Kham. So I think we are a very fierce people.
Uh-huh. For good reason.
For good reason, yes.
Yes.
It is a very difficult and hard land too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And nomadic life is very difficult, as much as it is beautiful land.
And you had asked Rinpoche Sering Drotsing, Drawutsang, or Drupan, to talk about the history of the region and how many families were there. And you had said that the wealthier paid taxes, but the poor families didn't have to. I thought that was interesting. You'd never find that here.
Yeah,
there was a sense of compassion, for sure, and equality that probably runs through their blood.
Yeah, in the old days, you know, that was how it was. Even the nomadic communities, people who had land and people who had herd, because riches, prosperity in those days, if you were a herder, was linked to the size of your herd. So if you had a particular a number of herd and if you had land, then you paid taxes to your chieftain, you know, and perhaps to the king of that kingdom.
But you had something to give.
But if you didn't have herd and if you didn't have land, then you were exempt from paying taxes. So I think in those days, taxes probably was, you know, you paid maybe 2-3 yaks or something. Mm-hmm. You gave that up. Or you gave butter.
Yak butter.
Yak butter, or you gave, you know, dried cheese or something related to your source of livelihood. And Rinchen Sering Dawutsang, he was the chieftain of Jeku. I mean, you know, prior to 1959, he's now in
prior
India.
Prior to the invasion.
Yes.
Has he told you stories about the time prior to the Chinese government? And
Yes. I mean, you know, all elders have their stories, and all my family members always have a lot of stories prior to that time.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to share any of them with us, or? It's all right if you don't.
I can't think of any one story.
There are probably so many.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, not so much of a story, but anything connected to preserving the culture, the cultural heritage. I know this is very important to keep the spirit of Tibet for the Tibetan people alive, mm-hmm. and I know that it is an aspiration of His Holiness the Dalai Lama as well.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
you mentioned, Tsering, when it comes to rebuild time, you know, how can people start thinking about this now and generating this awareness and bringing these points forth that, yes, we want Tibet and Tibetans to live, and how can we help to preserve the cultural significance of your people?
You know, I don't know. That's a very large question, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. On one level, you have the practical needs, you know, schools and hospitals, those kind of structures, if the schools are rebuilt so the children have a place to go, they can study and learn Tibetan, and, you know, if those kinds of focuses are made, if there's, you know, if the hospitals are rebuilt. And, you know, I think if the monasteries are also helped to be rebuilt, because for a lot of the people, the monasteries are often a source of great comfort and, mm-hmm. and a place where their cultural life and their, I think their historical sense of being, you know, they seek comfort in monasteries. So I think all those aspects are, I think, important. It's hard for me to say from here what would be the best way.
Right, those sound like really practical and important needs to be focused on, the schools, the hospitals, rebuilding the monasteries.
And I think just remembering, you know, because this is summer right now, and the needs will continue for a long time.
Yes.
You know, winter will come, they will need food, they will need warm shelter, and I'm sure by winter that rebuilding will not have taken place. So I think, you know, it would be wonderful if people can just hold on to just try and remember for as long as possible that they will be in need for a
mm-hmm.
long time.
Yes, so more tents, more food, more resources for them to get through the winter. money, yes. Money contributed for that, and to remember that this does take a long time, like you say, and not just to be really strong about it for a month or 2 months, but remembering again in the fall before winter comes to help again to continue.
Yeah.
And to keep their struggle in the news as well, and their need for donations. When the next calamity happens, sometimes the most recent victims are forgotten. So it's important to remember. And I just want to announce again the fundraising organizations that were recommended. It was JINPA, J-I-N-P-A Project, and the website is www.jinpa.org. And then Magic, www.magic, M-A-C-H-I-K.org. And then, how to pronounce it, ROKPA? www.rokpausa.org. And then, of course, the Tibetan Village Project. And I believe they're all on TANC, Tibetan Association of Northern California.
Link for all of them.
I think that's where I got these from. That is so essential. So are you having many fundraising events or gatherings in the Bay Area?
We are, the Tibetan Association has been holding prayer sessions and has been collecting money from the community. And I've been also just gathering funds from my friends to send to JINPA. So, all of us feel helpless because we really don't know how to help and be there for our Tibetans inside Tibet. So we're all trying in any way we can to, sort of just be mindful and see what they might be needing and how we can help them.
And has there been much of a response from the Chinese community in San Francisco? Have they reached out at all?
I don't know. I don't know if they have reached out to Tank. I have not heard anything. I have friends who have, personal friends, Chinese-American friends who have reached out, but I don't know as organizations if they have, as a community, if they have, probably as individuals they have.
Yeah, I'm sure they have. I will say prayers for the future rehabilitation. And do you think there's a chance that you'll be able to go over there in the not too distant future?
I don't know. I considered going there, and then I didn't know if I would be of any help. I just wanted to be with my aunt and just sit with her. I thought maybe that would be what I could do, but then I don't know if, it's hard to imagine how I could be of help. At least if I'm here, I can try and write about it or, bring more awareness. But maybe I might just find myself there, who knows.
And maybe later in the summer, our summer.
Maybe, yeah.
And Sarin, you said something about the difficulty of even getting over there. I mean, I know because of the earthquake, but is there anything that would be helpful to talk about the difficulty of getting over there and bringing more awareness to that subject, whether it's money and resources or people going to help, though I know money is the best need right now, but if we can bring any awareness to the difficulty of actually
getting there.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're an outsider, if you don't have family members there, then it is very difficult. The language is very, it's a different dialect that's spoken there. So, English is not spoken much in the town. You'd find very few people who speak English. Physically, just to travel there takes a while. But you'd have to go to Xining, and then from Xining, you can fly these days, but otherwise you have to take a car or a bus, and that takes a long time. And then right now the infrastructure, of the town is down, so it would be hard, you know, unless you have a very specific skill that's of use to the community, you know. Mm-hmm. I think probably money and, you know, more practical help is better than just showing up there,
sure.
You know.
Sure, yeah, I understand that.
I mean, a lot of Tibetans wanted to go there and just show the solidarity, but then I think even for Tibetans, you know, they realized, well, we don't know the dialect.
Uh-huh.
And we don't know anybody in the town, then what are we going to do?
Right, and then being taken care of on top of trying to take care of others and create more stability.
More bodies.
And,
yeah, I mean, you know, people are outside in tents, and even if, you know, you have half a house, you're out in the yard in a tent. And so how would the town take care of visitors? You know,
right.
I think that's also something to be mindful about.
Yeah.
There are a few hotels standing, but not too many of them, I think.
It would just put more stress on what they do have.
I think so. So, I think it has to be well thought out and well planned, unless
sure.
people are self-sufficient and well organized, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It might be that they will find themselves adding probably to the chaos or to the complexity of trying to help.
Yeah, rather than helping, even though they may have very good intentions.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, that's, I think, you know, emotionally all of us want to be there.
Oh, I can only imagine.
You know,
Yeah, I thought that when I looked at everything and I saw this medical camp, I said, oh, I can go and help. And then I got really practical and said, you know, I could probably help a lot more here just by being on the show and creating more awareness, sending money, gathering money. Visioning the town and the people being taken care of, you know, and that the resources come through, and that they're not forgotten, you know, and
keeping it in the forefront of people's awareness.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is difficult. You have so many things happening. I mean, you know, people have already forgotten Haiti, and you know, there's tremendous need and suffering continuing in Haiti,
and then Chile.
Sure, it's hard. Yeah.
I know.
Even right here in Louisiana, there's still...
Exactly.
It's so sad. I think of the marine wildlife, and it's just gut-wrenching.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it definitely is good to talk about it and bring awareness and cure your knowledge and wisdom and a family link right to the very village where this is happening.
I know it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like I'm... you know, of no use, and I'm helpless too. I just call them and just talk to them and ask them what they're doing, and, you know.
Yeah.
That's the only way these days I can...
You can't imagine, though, the solace that they feel hearing your voice and knowing what you can do over here for them, that they're not forgotten.
I hope so.
I can only imagine that if I were there. I'm sure your aunt and... you had written to me something else as you were saying goodbye, and you picked up her spirits by remembering, forget what it was, but she broke into a happy laugh. You said before, gacho, to each other last night. What does that mean?
Was it about the nine lives or something?
Oh,
yeah,
really?
No,
what's
Jigu,
that?
The town, you know, Jigu means... Nine lives.
Oh, Jigu. Oh,
the town. Oh, boy. Are they living up to it?
So I was just telling her, you know, the town has nine lives, so it'll be, you know, it'll be okay. So she was just laughing.
Oh, that's what it was.
So, Sering, is Jigu Kam or part of Kam?
Yes, Jigu is very much in Kam.
Okay.
It's part of Kam, yeah.
And that's why there's that fierceness. They have nine lives.
I know. I'd love to hear more about that. And it will see them through, I'm sure. It must have been difficult, though, for a nomadic culture to suddenly be put into homes of a sort, four walls, and not knowing how to make a living in a city. I imagine they got through that and are still probably struggling through it. And I'm glad to hear that many are still, some are still nomadic. You spoke about that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, Jigu has been a town for you know, many decades. So they have always had people living in town. And a lot of people who live there, you know, majority of the population have been moving slowly from, you know, they have nomadic roots, but, you know, a lot of them are educated, they work in the town. And then there is a population that has been in the town just for a short while, you know, a lot of resettled families from nomadic areas. So there are different groups in the town. Not everyone, you know, has moved just recently. So everyone has different affiliations and degrees of comfort in the town. You know, I'm sure for the new nomads, it probably is devastating because they've had to leave their homes and now they've lost everything that they have. So, I'm sure that it's difficult for them because they'll have to build their lives again. You know.
Right, there's no way to just pick up and go back out on the land and gather their yaks and, you know, the land has been erupted, destroyed, really.
And are there many Chinese there that have immigrated into the area?
There are Chinese, but the population is not as large as in other areas. There are a few Chinese officials, of course, in the town, and then there are traders, shopkeepers, and things like that. A lot of Chinese Muslims, you know, have moved in from the Xining area, but it's still largely a Tibetan town compared to many other regions of Tibet. You know, I mean, if you compare it to Lhasa, it's very different. In Lhasa, you have a very large Chinese population. Probably the Chinese population is larger than the Tibetan population. In Jeku, it's not that way at all. I would just guess that maybe the Chinese population is 10% or less. But that's just my guess. You know, it's largely a very Tibetan town. And the people who migrate also are Tibetans who migrate from the nomadic regions and come to Jeku.
So it's kind of a transition place, perhaps, from nomadic life.
It has always been, it has always been the largest town, so it's still a place where people are drawn to do their trade and, you know, to build their lives. And it's where all the schools are, you know, the better schools are in the town from the region. So it's still, you know, it's still the largest town of six nomadic sort of large provinces.
And how far out did the earthquake go? I don't know about those details as far as these other little surrounding villages where people have come from.
I think, you know, all of them felt the tremor. I was speaking to my cousins who live in the neighboring town of Shonda in Nangchin, which is about 3 hours by car, and they were saying they felt the earthquake, and, you know, they have a few cracks in their homes, but nobody suffered any injuries in Shonda, really, and there was there were no large collapses there. Similarly, in some other smaller neighboring villages, people felt the tremors, but I think it lost a few homes. There are some towns, though, in Tindu province, which I think Tindu, some of the towns there were destroyed. A few other villages besides Jeku have been affected, but most of the heaviest damages have been in the Jeku area and the neighboring sort of outskirts of Jeku.
Right. So in fact, that this is the main trade center. It's really important that some stabilization be had, and the people are taken care of, and that eventually it's restabilized and they're able to trade again.
Yes, it's a major hub.
Yeah, I mean, it's also the place where, it's the regional head for the six provinces, so most of the offices are there. So,
they will get to work.
Right now, you know, people have been going back to work. My cousins were all saying they've been asked to go back to work, and a lot of the offices are set up in tents, but people have been asked to get back to a normal routine. You know, people who have jobs have to be at their jobs. And a lot of these offices are involved in providing relief also, so they're quite busy.
Yeah.
I think on the Richter scale it was a 6.9.
Yes, that's what
I believe. And those can be devastating if they aren't if the buildings aren't earthquake proof. We had an earthquake here before I moved in 1988, I believe, and people were working in tents. I moved here 2 years ago, and they were still, a lot of the businesses were still in tents.
Oh, wow.
So it does take a while.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of these homes are old homes. You know, they're sort of built with this brick and mud compact and then wood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the house, my aunt's house, where I was last year for 4 months, that house just collapsed, and a section of it was new, and parts of the, you know, new wing is standing, but most of the house just collapsed because it's all old mud and old wood.
Yes,
You know, they're using the wood now, of course, to cook their meals outside, and they have a little makeshift stove, and so they say they have wood, at least, from the house to burn. But, you know, most of the residences in town were old houses, so they were the first ones to go down.
Oh, that may change in the rebuilding if it's an earthquake-prone area.
Yes, I'm sure now in the future they will build with, you know, with earthquakes in mind, probably. Or at least they'll build with more firmer substance.
And to get back to why I think a lot of the media didn't realize it was Tibet, I imagine that the names have been changed of the regions. And they weren't familiar with the names. They have changed. It's now Western China and Eastern Tibet.
Yes.
Sure.
I think that's confusing. You know, that's confusing for Tibetans too. I think
I bet
a lot of my Tibetan friends are not aware of the history of this place. Which, you know, I mean, traditionally, this region was under Kham, Eastern Tibet, which was the sort of the denominations that were set up by Tibetans, which was the three areas of Kham, which was Dotu, and then Dome, and and then Utsang, which is central Tibet, and Dome was the regions of Amdo and Golo. And with the Chinese invasion, what happened was that Kham, you know, we had a very clear sense of the regions that were under Kham in the Tibetan system.
Mm-hmm.
And those areas were broken down and divided into Chinese provinces, existing Chinese provinces. So my area, you know, came under the Qinghai province, you know, and some of my traditional area came under the TAR province, which is sort of the Tibet Autonomous Region.
Mm-hmm.
So the original shape of the land has been shifted and broken up, you know, sort of cut up and then distributed in different areas, which
how disorienting,
you know, is disorienting anyway. And then they've also been given
separating
new names, you know. So Jeku is Yushu, or it's like Jekundo, but written in the Chinese, it becomes something completely different. So in that way, I think you know, people can't recognize their own places, and you can't recognize the names of Tibetans either, because they're all sinicized. So my name would become like Sai Zhang or something. So nobody knows whether it's a Chinese person or whether it's a Tibetan person, because when you look at the names, it's not a recognizable Tibetan name, you know. So in that way,
So they're kind of taking the language
everything
away.
So it distorts the names and sounds, and you can't recognize your own, you know, in a way.
And the dialects were so important in recognizing where individuals were from. That you're meeting, it sounds like, historically. And now it's all being more homogenized. It sounds like.
That's really sad. I know, even looking at a geography book, looking at a map, you see China these days, but you don't see Tibet anymore. And this is very, very sad. To hear
it
this.
Really is. This is alarming. Painful. We have a song that we'd like to share that Karuna brought. Would you be interested in hearing it?
I'd love to.
It's all actually, right. Well, it was written by somebody very special to me. I'm not going to say his name here, but he's very special and highly respected. He's very highly respected Tibetan Rinpoche, and he wrote this after a trip to Tibet in the 90s, and it's called A Sad Song of Endless Tears for the People of Tibet. And when he had returned from his travels, he had a group of us. We would go around and do Ryo Sancho fire offerings, and he would have us sing this to the community. And so I'll share that now. It is sad, but it's also a prayer of sorts. Alas, you who promise to protect the people of Tibet, our only father, precious Maha Guru, you have emanated from the Dharmakaya state of Amitabha. You are the speech light of Chenrezig, born from the lotus in Nirmanakaya form. Do you notice the suffering of the people of Tibet? If you have compassion, now is the time to save Tibet. If you have power, now is the time for action. It is almost too late to save Tibet. The land of Tibet is nearly destroyed. The power of the evil force, the barbarians' actions are extremely strong, caught in the storm of discrimination and prejudice, although without guilt, one is blamed and tortured. They are the real rakshas, so cruel and ruthless. The innocent Tibetans are severely punished. They experience the real sufferings of the hell realms even before they die. O precious Maha Guru, do you see what is happening to Tibet? Please show your compassion and magical powers. Even Dharma practitioners have no freedom. They have no shelter and have become scattered beggars. Everyone in Tibet is in a state of fear. This beautiful snow land of Tibet is no longer one's homeland, but is instead a strange country. Everywhere, wherever one goes, roam the barbarians. They are boasting about their violent conduct, dangerous weapons, and evil substances. By the poisons of these vibrations, the whole environment is degenerating. Many strange diseases shorten the lives of the people. In whatever way one thinks, it makes one very sad. O precious Mahaguru, do you see the sufferings of the people of Tibet? If you care, now is the time to save Tibet. Please show your compassion and magical powers. We have no freedom or rights in our own country. We face hundreds of problems and difficulties. We are made to wander to the far ends of the world like stray dogs searching for food. Where we go or what we do is always uncertain. Being homeless, others look down upon us. O precious Maha Guru, may you relieve the sufferings of the people of Tibet. Please show your compassion and magical powers.
Oh,
that's
thank
very
you
beautiful.
For sharing that. Painful. Very sad. Well, we're going to have to end. Our hour has come to an end. And I have to, any of you, our next guest, Saring, I just want to announce once more, oops, if I have it, the...
I have it here.
Here we go. The fundraising organizations that people can donate to. And the first one is Jinpa. They're all www. Beforehand. And then Jinpa, GINPA.org. And then Magic, MACHIK.org. And then Rokpa, ROKPAUSA.org. And then TANIC, TANIC.
Do we have time for dedication?
No. Really?
Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead, yes.
So I'll see what gets out there, but this is a prayer to pacify global warming. Thank you so much, Saring. It's been lovely to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
May the blessings of the exalted sources of refuge, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the three jewels, and the Lama, Yidam, and protectors, the three roots, pacify the terrors of illness, famine, and war, and chaos in the elements, the temperatures unbalanced, grand snow mountains, hard, firm glaciers will melt and disappear, rivers and lakes becoming scarce, the forests of the ancients and the trees of beauty, too, will near their deaths. There is a frightful danger the world's reaches will become a great wasteland. May these coming dangers be fully pacified and sublime good fortune and happiness spread all around. May all beings nurture one another lovingly and kindly so their joy may blossom. May all their aims be fulfilled like the Dharma. And this is by the ninth Trangu Tukul Rinpoche.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to say that your prayers are in the hearts of many, and our prayers as well for your people. Your strong people, strong in heart and being. Kampas. Thank you, Saring.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was Saring, and truly, I know that her people need help, and if you have anything at all to spare, please give something to the organizations that we just spoke about. And right now I'm going to play a song, Where Is Your Soul?, a song inspired by greed. We're going to be speaking with Russ Baker, the author of A Family of Speakits when we of Secrets when we return. There you go. Let's see if this comes on now. Whoops, there's a little bit of a time lag here, pardon me. There we go.
You got fancy cars and riches, but where is your soul? Got those greedy itches, now you've lost control. Be learned from this. Yes, everything grows old. It's hard to find some shelter when you're left out in the cold. You're captivated by greed. Everything you need. Except for a true friend. When we were young, none of us quite knew how you would end up to do the things you do. Where is the soul I know that you once had? Name the reasons why you lost it could only make me sad. You forgot how to love, so you went on the attack. When you learn to love again, your soul will come back. Immoral, feel like you're King Kong, wonder why your soul never lasted long. You don't even know what I mean when I sing this song. That's for you to guess, me to know. Then we'll get along.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the second hour of Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the heartland of Santa Cruz, and you're listening to Free Radio 101.1 FM, and I have on the telephone with us now Russ Baker, and he is the author of Family of Secrets, and it's the Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. He was with us last in January, and he spoke at length about George Bush Sr.'s involvement in the assassination of Kennedy, and we touched upon his role in Watergate as well, and much, much more. But he's also an award-winning investigative reporter with a track record for making sense of complex and little understood matters, and that's kind of an understatement. He has a website, Who, What, Why, and he practices forensic journalism, and I'd like him to address that as well. And another website, RussBaker.com, and then FamilyOfSecrets.com. Let me make sure he's with us. Russ, are you with us?
I am.
Hi. Hi. And I have my co-host with me, too, and her name is Teresa Caraggio.
Hi, Russ.
Okay. Hi.
I'm going to turn you up a bit. We're having a hard time hearing you. Before we really get into the book, I'd like to ask you a bit about your new website, Forensic Journalism, Who, What, Why.
Sure. WhoWhatWhy.com. It is a nonprofit investigative news site. We started it because with conventional, traditional, old-fashioned newspaper journalism and all the rest of it sort of in a state of collapse. We don't know what's going to replace it. What we see so far on the internet is a lot of sort of frenetic material. We see a lot of opinion. We see a lot of entertainment-related things. We don't yet see a lot of substantive, careful, investigative work. And so that is why I and a number of other people have started WhoWhatWhy.com. Mm-hmm. People can go to the site. They can see on along the right-hand side the sort of substantive stories we're doing. And along the left-hand side, we have a blog. We hope to increase the frequency with which we publish things on the site. We are dependent entirely on the support of the public, and so it's sort of dependent on how much money we raise, how quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. The most recent investigative article is called The Game That Goes On and On, A Swiss Bank, A President, and the Permanent Government. And this is a fairly lengthy exploration of something that started when last summer I saw heard about President Obama's first significant vacation of the summer in Martha's Vineyard, and that he had gone golfing. The stories that I saw were all very light. There was no substance to them at all. But I did notice the New York Times mentioned that in his foursome on the golf course was an aide, an old friend from Chicago, a physician. And the fourth person, it said, described as Robert Wolf, president of UBS Investment Bank.
It's the Union Bank of Switzerland.
Right, described him as a top campaign contributor, and it just said, call it donor maintenance. And then the Times opted not to inquire any more about why this particular man was on vacation with President Obama. I was very interested because I knew that UBS had just been the subject of a very serious investigation by the U.S. government for encouraging and enabling people to basically defraud the government and mm-hmm. to essentially evade taxes, and that UBS had just paid $750 million fine for this. And I thought, well, here he is. The head of this bank is being given a special, almost a reward that anybody would have wanted, and he's with the president. I wanted to know more, and so that article is an exploration of what is that about.
Yeah.
Russ, this is Teresa. I was very interested in that article, especially the way it opened with Jenna Bush's interview of Clinton. I do a
right, that's a different article. That's part of our blog.
Oh, I see. Yes, yes. But I that was curious to me. I do a radio show called Third Paradigm, and in it I had one video clip of Alexandra Pelosi interviewing Bush. I think it's Travels with Bush. Isn't that the documentary that she made? Nancy Pelosi's daughter?
I know she did make a documentary. I haven't seen it.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually, I thought she did a much better job. I mean, she really didn't actually softball him. She asked some penetrating questions that I don't think anyone else would have been in a position to ask. But it's interesting.
Right. My blog post that you're referring to is about how the Today Show, which describes itself at least in part as a news program, hired the daughter of ex-President George W. Bush as a special correspondent. And here we have a link from whowhatwhy.com to this interview. And you see her interviewing former President Bill Clinton, throwing softballs at him. And then I just remark upon the unusually close relationship between the Bush family and the Clintons, mm-hmm. Which, by the way, is addressed somewhat in the article on Who, What, Why, UBS, about UBS and Obama,
is.
But much more substantively in my book, Family of Secrets, mm-hmm. where essentially what that is that's a deep dig on, as the subtitle says, 50 years of hidden American history, the relationships of these very powerful financial entities, and moreover, of what really is tantamount to an American oligarchy, and presidents, and I mean presidents of both parties, and mm-hmm. in fact with every president. And this is something that is just simply ignored by the vast majority of the American media.
It certainly is, and I believe a lot of that is intentional.
I think it's intentional, but it's a kind of self-censorship. It's not because any individual person is particularly bad. It is a calculation that we all make in order to keep our jobs.
Exactly, and it's understandable, and yet, nonetheless, we are in a very dangerous time because the truth isn't getting out, and that's why I love having you on, because you do delve deeply, and you document everything. You have a lot of credibility as well.
Thank you very much. I mean, it's a lot of work to do this type of research. And, you know, what has happened is, I mean, there always was a problem because for-profit journalism, basically what they want is, when you're trying to generate profits, what you're trying to do is turn out as much material as quickly and cheaply as possible and mm-hmm. to snag as many eyeballs as you can. Now, some of these for-profit organizations did fairly good investigative journalism because they couldn't have all entertainment and weather and sports and so forth. And so they knew that there was a certain percentage of the mix needed to be substantive and deep. But now that that model has sort of collapsed, there really becomes the question of who's going to do it. And, you know, many people, of course, have their favorite websites they go to. But if you look at them carefully, there isn't any investigative mm-hmm. journalism. It's all repurposing stuff that they read elsewhere. Or commenting on things or mm-hmm. expressing opinions.
That's why I was so intrigued by Who, What, Why, because you are filling in that gap. In your
book,
it's just the tip of the
iceberg. Well, we're making a darned effort at it. As I say, the struggle is going to be, will ordinary Americans say, you know what, this is really important. This country is in deep trouble. We desperately need accurate information. I'm going to say, you know, I don't make a lot of money, but I can afford $20 or $50 a month or mm-hmm. 25 or whatever to help these people do this kind of work. That's really where the crunch is going to be.
And Russ, I like the way that you point out that the Bush family and really any politicians are not really the powers, you know, that they're merely the operatives and that other USB are the ones in power. I think it was Thomas Hobbes who said something to that effect, that if someone seems to be in power, look elsewhere.
Right.
So
that's very keen. That's very keen.
That's
true, because if you think about it, first of all, presidents are people who are there for a limited amount of time. They mm-hmm. most of them don't come themselves, with a few exceptions, from tremendous wealth. Even the Bushes, as I note in Family of Secrets, are really not all that wealthy, and they've never really been that money oriented. There, other things motivate them.
What do you think motivates them?
Well, this gets into a deep kind of a metaphysical thing. You know, last night I had a long discussion with somebody who has another website and a very interesting and thoughtful person who we were discussing this. What really makes these people tick? Why would people do things that seem to be essentially sort of killing this country? And moreover, if you consider the bigger issues like a state of total worldwide war, the possibility that scientists tell us that within a century or less, there may not even be the possibility of life on Earth because of climate change. And so you think, what makes these people tick? And in Family of Secrets, I kind of begin getting into that, and I do it very, very carefully, because the material, the factual material itself, which is all documented, and I've got 1,000 footnotes, it itself is so explosive that when you go even beyond that and you start saying, what are these people about, it's hard for folks to accept this. But in a nutshell, here's where I think this goes. A lot of these people convince themselves that, A, they are good people, and, B, they convince themselves that they are the only ones who know what is good for civilization, and that it is necessary to have this kind of a hierarchy and to impose upon people things that may be unpleasant, that may even keep them in poverty, but that this is absolutely necessary for the continuation of civilization. You simply can't have a fairer system, and this is what they convince themselves. And also, by the way, many of them join these organizations which enforce a kind of an internal philosophy and internal cohesion. This is why throughout Family of Secrets, I very sort of briefly mention how many of these people are members of things like Skull and Bones or other secret societies, or they've joined, a huge number of them. This astonished me, because it's not a specialization of mine, but it astonished me when I researched so many people involved with the Bushes, how many of them were, you know, 33rd degree Masons and all of this stuff, a grand marshal, grand masters of these things. They create this other world, basically, for themselves.
Russ, it really makes me curious as to what's motivating Obama, because the best thing that I thought could come out of Obama's election is that everyone who thought that they could change things by changing who was in that office would be disillusioned. And that's, of course, been proven true. But now the question becomes, for me, is he naive, is he complicit, or is he, as Hugo Chavez says, a prisoner? And you know, in any case, he's powerless, but the reasons would really change the strategy.
And is he up against this insidious military, what would you call them? Military...
industrial complex?
No, not so much industrial. I suppose so, but it's more of an intelligence community that they're up against, that tends to be follow or get their tentacles into all the administrations.
Or the banking interest, you know.
All of those interests and how they work together is really the underpinning of Family of Secrets. And what I do is I document the connections between financial elites, military elites, military contracting elites, interests that are involved principally with the extraction of natural resources, of course, oil and petroleum products being the most important, but many, many others also being significant. And when you go back, you find that the certain families in America, and the Bushes, but more so the wealthier families that we don't know about, but that they have served for generations, in which I document, that these folks have always had their hand, you know, on the tiller. And so, for example, you see that the Bush family, going back many, many generations, they were always in the Navy, and they were involved with naval intelligence. And naval intelligence, long before there was a CIA or an OSS, this was the way that wealthy interests in the United States got their information about resources abroad. And, of course, the Navy was the principal means of transporting both troops, as well as the booty, the resources that were being brought back from these foreign lands, and so they did that. And by the way, I just learned that Jeb Bush's son, George P. Bush, joined the Navy several years ago, Naval Reserve,
of course.
And he is, of course, in intelligence work.
Just keeping it in the family. That's probably the role they have within this elite of sorts. I really don't know. That's just speculation on my part, but
that's maybe the seventh or eighth generation of the family with Navy connections.
And I had heard that there was a Bush, one of the Sheldon Prescott. I had someone on the radio last week who said that because Santa Cruz was a seaport and close to San Francisco, that there was a rumor that Sheldon Prescott Bush had been here and had been involved in some activity. Anyway, it goes way back. And then you have Wells Fargo, and they were involved with that in some capacity. But
well, actually, if you want to talk about the greater San Francisco Bay Area, in my research I found that this ancestor of the Bush is going back. This is a great-great-grandfather, that he was a lawyer who became a minister, and first he had one of the wealthiest congregations on the East Coast, and then he came out west, and he was the minister to all these fabulously wealthy, gold rush and railroad families on Nob Hill.
Yes, I'm from Boston. I remember hearing stories about it there, and then when I moved here, I was hearing some of the same stories, and, it's kind of freeing to talk about it, but I usually, particularly on the air, I usually don't. But that's all, I heard the same thing.
Well, the significance of that is just that what you're looking at is really the kind of thing that people in other countries are much more familiar with, and this is an idea that is essentially denied in the United States. We create this myth that this is this great egalitarian country where democracy functions extremely well. And in fact, of course, you're talking about Obama. When you look at the money that he collected, sure, he got money from hundreds of thousands, perhaps maybe even several million people on the Internet, but fully half of all the money he raised came in much larger sums through bundlers, through people principally on Wall Street, many of them involved with hedge funds, and with the exact same products that, of course, contributed so directly to the economic collapse. And so that factor is significant, and those people hedge their bets. If you study their contributions, they or their spouses or the partners in their firms give money to both. And as I document in this new article on whowhatwhy.com, the UBS Bank, the Swiss bank, the chairman was one of the top bundlers for Obama. That's the man who was golfing with him. And one of the vice chairmen was a guy named Phil Graham. He'd been a U.S. senator. He was the head of the banking committee that basically deregulated all of this stuff. Then he leaves and he joins this UBS bank, and he becomes the top economic advisor to John McCain. And so you've got this one Swiss bank that's involved with all this hanky-panky, and their top people are in both camps in the presidential election. So it hardly matters who wins.
Russ, I have a question. I'd like to know your theory on why Lehman Brothers was allowed to fail. Because in all those bank bailouts, I mean, they're one of the boys. You know, they're definitely in the club. So why? It just seems like there's something fishy going on, that they did all these bailouts, but then they let Lehman Brothers fail.
I'm not an expert on that, but I will tell you one thing that I find very interesting, and that is that one of the officials of Lehman Brothers was a cousin of George W. Bush, and when Lehman Brothers failed, he picked up the most lucrative piece of the company for next to nothing.
Oh,
right. That's what I was thinking, that they took everything out first.
There you go.
I mean, I look at the economic shenanigans as far back as 1999. I think I'm the only woman I know to have taken her husband to marriage counseling armed with spreadsheets, where I said, I'm looking at these stocks, and it's all perception. It's a house of cards based on perception, and there's this fear about 2000, and I think it's going to fall. I think it's all going to crash, and I want to take half of our savings out. And I look at the fact that it was February. Every person wants to sell stock in January, because then you have 15 and a half months before you have to pay taxes on it. So what I think is that with any brokerage, you can just swap the stocks back and forth. All you have to do is make sure somebody's buying when you're selling. So if you have one of the funds buying at the time the other one's selling, you can keep that stock price high until all the principals sell off their shares, and then you just let it fall, which is what seemed to me to have happened with that manipulated fall in February of 2000.
Well, let me say this. I mean, this is part of this larger mythology that I'm talking about. We have a mythology that, economists are serious, scientific people who know what they're talking about, that Wall Street is some dignified, crucial part of our structure, when in fact, of course, many of much of economics is charlatanism. It's entirely a guesswork, or at least much of it is. And as far as Wall Street goes, this is gambling, it's insider trading. It's who you know. It's intelligence work is really what it is, by the way.
Yes.
Which is that explains also the close connection between the intelligence world and finance. And when you look at, by the way, the president's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, and you look at the people on there, I mean, Bush put this Hunt fellow, who, you know, what did he know? I mean, he was in the oil business. But that's what oil's all about. And then he got this exclusive contract to drill in Kurdistan. It's all the stuff is it's about gaming the system and basically screwing everybody who's not on the inside. And so yes, Lehman and all of these things, there's another story there, and we don't get those stories because even the better journalists, there's a limit to how deep they can dig.
And you also, in this article that you wrote, UBS, you quoted it's untold billions squandered. I like that. You write about the fact that this bank has shielded money for so many, and they've given them their own cell phones, and they've just hidden their money. They hide taxable income, and that's just what they do. And Obama is enmeshed in all of this, too. And my hunch that if he was not, he wouldn't be there. And that's why the medical reform was not quite a reform, although he championed himself as being a president of change. He's not, his hands are tied very tightly right now.
Yeah. Well, keep in mind that a lot of these financiers got in behind him very early. I've just been, the last few days, I've been looking at some numbers, and I see certain people contributing to him, not just when he ran for president, but actually before he was a U.S. senator. And so some of them were targeting him as this promising, attractive guy who was likely to move up quickly, at least to be a power in the U.S. Senate. And so while I'm hesitant to question his own values, because I don't have any evidence that he has bad values, but the reality is that he was an enormously ambitious fellow who never really distinguished himself for being a big risk-taker for, let's say, populist positions. That's never who he was. And so you see these people getting behind him. By the way, UBS, absolutely. I mean, they, as I document to some extent in the article on Who, What, Why, and in much more detail in my book, Family of Secrets, UBS, you see these connections to the rise not just of Obama, but directly or indirectly, there are connections to Clinton. There are connections to George W. Bush himself on his way up prior to even becoming governor of Texas. And then you see them involved with such people or entities as the South African apartheid regime, with UBS playing a crucial role in basically keeping the apartheid system going and getting medals from that government, helping Ferdinand Marcos, who stole vast amounts of money from and impoverished people of phenomenal islands that are just full of natural wealth. He impoverished them. A lot of the aid money for the United States was stolen, and he was deeply involved with UBS. You see the same thing with the Shah of Iran, and on. I document all of those things. But these are very troubling outfits, and they certainly need more scrutiny.
It has seemed to me, this is Teresa, excuse me, like it would be helpful if we had a shorthand way of referring to those people who ultimately in the world pull the strings. I see so much divisiveness now between being bipartisan, the Democrats versus Republicans, or in the larger world, you know, the Alba nations against the United States, or that these are two large of groups. That the way I've been referring to it is the Bilderberg 50. That I think that there's actually no more than 50 families where they are making evil decisions in complete freedom, you know, where they don't really have anyone who's pulling their strings. Do you think that's high or low, or do you have a way of referring to that group?
I don't, because I don't usually see things as a highly organized structural thing. I think that, for example, there are families that have been involved in consolidating their power for a long time, but that there are certain members who become sort of dissidents and, you know, give money to good causes. Then some families, their wealth is dissipated. And so also, you see new wealth coming up all the time. I mean, mm-hmm. I think Gandhi put it best, where he just really talked about that the biggest problem in the whole world is basically greed. And greed is not particular to any group, a country, mm-hmm. or family. And so the problem is that to do the research on this stuff, you have to both have the specific names, because it means nothing without the specific names, mm-hmm. specific examples, but you also need the big picture, and it's complicated, and, you know, people are busy, and they get tired, and they want everything given to them in a sound bite, and this is why there are all these alarmist books about, you know, the Bilderberg Group and what have you, and that's not who's running the world. Mm-hmm. That is wrong. The world is a much more complex place, and these very powerful people, by the way, feud with each other. They stab each other in the back, they sue each other, they make alliances when it benefits them, and they break them when mm-hmm. it benefits them. It's much more complicated.
And so it's about understanding power, and you look for the patterns, and that's how you come up with this amazing research. You know what to look for.
I do look for patterns. I also go in, by the way, with no preconceptions. That is crucial to the work I've done for the last 20-some years, and it's crucial to the mission of Who, What, Why, which is we don't have any sacred cows. We're not partial to the Republicans or the Democrats or business or labor or anything. We're partial to basic principles of decency and fairness, which most people claim that they subscribe to, irrespective of any other labels.
Mm-hmm. You know, to get back to your book, one of the most startling revelations when I first read it was the Watergate exposure. And we started to talk about it the last time you were on, and how the intelligence community had infiltrated his administration, and that he really probably was being taped, and how he was framed so brilliantly. Can you share that with our listeners somewhat, what you unearthed?
Yeah, and I just want to preface this by saying that many of the things that Family of Secrets point to are extremely jarring and disturbing, and they were jarring and disturbing to me, and these were basically changed my perception of so many things. And so, for example, having grown up as a progressive community, and having just thought of, you know, Richard Nixon as sort of the Antichrist, and Woodward and Bernstein were the heroes, and, you know, Watergate was all the excesses of this paranoid and power-hungry Nixon, when I really began digging into who the Bushes were and how they came to power and who was behind them, and tracing this whole trajectory and discovering one thing after another that I hadn't known, that wasn't in any books, eventually this led me to this, what I discovered was a secret relationship between the Bush family on the one hand and their financier circle, and on the other, Richard Nixon, and that this went all the way back way to the 1940s when Nixon first was drafted into politics. And so trying to understand that, I then tracked the relationship between George H.W. Bush, Bush 41, and Nixon giving him all of these opportunities, which allowed the elder Bush then to eventually become president. And as I looked at that, I started noticing things that I found so disturbing, and they had a lot to do with Nixon. And so basically the shorthand here is this is about H.W. Bush's secret role in intelligence, very, very covert intelligence operations, domestic operations that were totally illegal and that we don't know about, that's never been reported before. This is long before he became CIA director, because people say, oh, well, we knew he was CIA director. This is long before that. And so there was something going on with these people, these financiers, these elite interests, and the CIA were basically shaping presidencies. And when presidents were not cooperating, they were responding to that. And so the shorthand is that Richard Nixon basically didn't do what he was told. And when he became president, he started exercising his independence. He actually was quite moderate in many, many respects on health and safety and environment and on some labor things and in negotiating with America's Cold War enemies. Mm-hmm. He was not playing ball with these people. He wasn't playing ball with many of these key industries. And he was distrustful of the CIA. He was at loggerheads with the generals, and at some point, the evidence shows they wanted him out, and that's exactly what they did, that they set him up. They put people into the White House who did certain things. that caused Nixon harm that he from which he was unable to recover.
And it's all documented well in your book, too.
Well, I mean, The Family of Secrets is almost 600 pages. There's more than 1,000 footnotes, and there are declassified documents, and I interviewed hundreds of people. That's the way you have to do this kind of stuff.
I almost finished with it. Not quite, because it's fascinating to read, and it's hard to believe it's for real, but it is. And then do you want to say a little bit about Bush Sr.'s role in Kennedy assassination?
Well, I mean, I'm very careful how I talk about that and how I characterize it. What I would say is this. Basically, I discovered certain patterns involving the elder Bush's companies going all the way back to the 1950s. What appear to just about everyone who's looked at the material that I have in the book, that his early companies way back then were involved with covert operations, that they were some sort of cover. And this is going, as I say, the 50s and then the early 60s, then discovering that Bush, Elder Bush had claimed he couldn't remember where he was on November 22, 1963. That question, and this is how I work, I just took that question. I thought, well, that's so strange. I can't leave that alone. I've got to answer why someone who was, you know, 40 years old at the time can't remember where he was. And so I spent several years during the 5 years that I spent on all kinds of things for Family of Secrets, exploring this. And the things I uncovered, which are documented in four chapters of all new material about the Kennedy assassination, were the connections between Mr. Bush, his friends, CIA people, and people directly connected to Lee Harvey Oswald, to the changes in the motorcade on November 22, 1963, to the investigation, to the Dallas Police Department, to an underground communications bunker that was operating that day. This stuff goes on and on and on. And, you know, if, as a friend said to me, boy, if the stuff you have in your book really are just coincidence, that's the greatest set of coincidences ever.
And then there were four specific documents that you unearthed as well that Bush tried to cover for his whereabouts, and he made it. I read that part of the book a while ago because I wanted to finish it before you came on again, and I don't remember the exact details, but he was trying to frame someone as a possible assassin. He made a phone call.
This is very, very complex stuff, and what I try to explain to people is this. You know that you're looking at an intelligence operation when there's so many confusing papers, because you see, it's many operations. If you do something like in the case of the man who allegedly was assassinated by the Mossad in Dubai, if you look at what happened to the Russian in London with the plutonium poisoning and so forth, all of these things, one thing is the act itself, which in that case, you know, whether it's putting something in somebody's tea or getting into their room, that's an operation which for these outfits is not that difficult. To get a shooter to shoot somebody in an open car moving slowly, it's not that difficult either. What's difficult is all the subterfuge around it, cloaking it, preparing for it, and then more importantly, making sure that whoever was responsible for these things is never held accountable. And so what you see with these documents are what appear to be covers. And so one of them is, this is the same man who couldn't remember where he was on November 22, 1963. This document comes to light. It's from the FBI, interestingly, not from the CIA. And it says that on November 22, 1963, at 1:45 p.m., a man identifying himself as George H.W. Bush, giving his age, saying he's an oil executive, and giving his address in Houston, and it's the same address of the man who would later become president, that he called the FBI office in Houston, and he said, I hear that the president has been shot in Dallas. I don't know why he wouldn't call the Dallas FBI office. And he says, I just want to say I'd like to be helpful, and I've heard some rumors about a guy who, you know, could be a suspect in this thing. This is before Oswald was publicly identified, and he gives the name of a man, and in Family of Secrets, as you know, I have a whole chapter just on this phone call, because it's the most incredible thing, and I, as I discover, he says, I don't really know this guy, but I've heard that he's been threatening the president, and as I discover in my research, he does know this guy, and he knows that he hasn't been threatening the president, that he wasn't capable of doing this, that it's very, very clear to him That this man was nothing, that this was a red herring, this phone call. And I go into, if it was a red herring, what was the actual purpose of this phone call? And it's cover. It's a phone call that basically establishes in government records that he's trying to be helpful and that his whereabouts at 1:45 p.m., which is in a town other than Dallas, although it happens to be just a short distance from Dallas, and mm-hmm. that really is where this thing goes.
Mm.
So, Russ, you make it abundantly clear that it doesn't really matter who we get into office because they really can't do anything. I think the next guest on the program with the Deep Democracy Workshop will probably make it abundantly clear that you can't get Congress to do anything because they don't have any real power. You know, the power is in the administrative office and judicial offices. So where do we go from here? How do we undo this?
Well, first of all, I think the key is wisdom. And wisdom comes from knowledge, and knowledge comes from information.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love to say, you know, get out and protest or do this or do that or, you know, hide from all of this in your, you know, making yourself feel better mode, which a lot of people are doing nowadays. But that's not the solution. We have to first start waking up from this dream state. We have to start knowing what actually is going on because you know this in your own life. Mm-hmm. If you're in a, let's say, a situation with a significant other and there are problems there, the key is to figure out what's going on first. It's the same thing with our health. If we're not feeling well, the most important thing is to get a diagnosis, to figure out what's going on, because until we figure out what's going on, we can't even know how to fix anything. And so I have to say, you know, when I started doing shows when Family of Secrets first came out, every host would ask that question, gee, you know, do we have hope? What can we do? Mm-hmm. And I would try to talk about different things people could do. But I now have narrowed it down to a very, very simple thing, which is, get yourself informed. You know, read. Learn all of these facts, because once you know the facts, you start assessing things realistically, and you start more, as importantly, you start sharing your newfound knowledge with others. I mean, the great thing about the digital age is those of us who felt totally impotent, that we couldn't communicate things to people, that's not true anymore. There, everybody listening to this program, assuming they all have a computer and an internet connection, or they can go to an internet cafe, they can reach out within minutes to dozens, perhaps even hundreds of people and say, hey, whatever it is. I mean, look, I'd love for them all to say, hey, read Family of Secrets, but if it's not that, whatever it is, read whatever it is that people think they ought to read, spread it, pass it around. And the amazing thing is, I'm finding that even people who are not activists, who don't describe themselves as reform-minded or anything else, that they're actually interested in these things. And if it's presented to them in a way where people don't seem to have an explicit part of an agenda, they'll look at it. And, you know, if we can spread the information, I mean, one of my favorite sayings is, there's more of us than there are of them.
Yeah,
I agree with you.
And, you know, that's the secret.
I agree with you about that. We're working on something we call the Universe City, CITY, and it's an alternative form of education so that we can take topics like a people's history of the United States or of any of these topics and can do deep research into economics, into politics, because what I've realized, using that same analogy about the diagnosis, is that people are looking for an answer, but they don't really know what the problem is yet. And so even if you have an answer, they don't recognize it because they're not at a point yet of really understanding what the problem is. And for that, you need the kind of research that people have to put real time in. And right now we have people, you know, kids paying tremendous amounts, parents paying tremendous amounts to send their kids to colleges to get a corporate-driven education. If we took those kids and instead gave them credit, since we can't afford to pay anybody to do this research, we can get a free labor force doing some of the work. Yeah, and we can also raise an informed generation.
Yeah.
Well, that's right. And in fact, you know, as someone who is a college graduate and who has a master's degree and everything, obviously I do believe there's a value to a conventional education. But the reality is that most of the things we're talking about will never appear on campus. And that is because there's this tremendous amount of self-censorship to survive in the system. The number of professors who really will bring these kind of things and these kind of books to their students are extremely low, and even those that we hold up, and you know who they are, these famous people who have teaching positions, who have an alternative analysis, even they will not touch certain subjects. They won't touch the long history of political assassinations in this country, which have all been chalked up to lone kooks, despite the unlikelihood, even statistically, that would always be the case. They won't touch these things, and that's basically for career preservation. So we need to look elsewhere in many ways for our education.
And even if the students graduate knowing what they need to do, they'll be either deep in debt or broke and won't have the ability to do it anyway.
Presently, but that yeah, it is. But you write in your conclusion, deception resides at the very center of our national psyche. It affects us in incalculable ways, from decisions in the voting booth to our own life choices. And truly, the solution is to pull away the veil as they come out of that dream. And it's a lot of work, and many people are like ostriches. They have their head in the sand. It's frightening to come to this truth, I think, for a lot of people, too. I've been trying to share it, and I don't really know how. It's like how to spoil a dinner party. Did you know? And it can be delicate. Do you have any suggestions?
It's very difficult. I mean, I don't have a simple explanation, although I think that you have to find those entry points when you're talking to people. I like to start with popular culture, because the same people who watch one of my favorites, Jim Carrey in The Truman Show, where he discovers that his whole life everybody in there are actors and the whole thing is a setup. This is, course, it's a parable or a metaphor or whatever, but these people working in Hollywood are able to put these ideas out there. Mm-hmm. Shows like things like South Park and so forth. You know, these people are trying through fictional means to raise a lot of these issues. And so if you just sort of talk to people, did you see that episode? Did you see that movie? Did you see, there was that movie, what was it called, Conspiracy Theory with the Taxi Driver? Those movies are not just intended to be entertainment. Those are people who are trying to communicate ideas. Mm-hmm. And so if we start by talking about those things and then you say, you know what, that's not all made up, you may want to check out such and such and such, and just telling people specific things that you discover or you read, it's a way to sort of ease them over to it. And then, don't hit them over the head with too much. Let them, and then give them a URL. Tell them about, who, what, why.com or Family of Secrets or Naomi Klein or, whatever it is that interests you. Just tell people about it and let them on their own, wade into the water when the temperature is right.
Mm-hmm. Great answer, and it's very helpful. I don't think I'm very delicate or graceful in this. But could you talk about what Obama is up against right now? What else you think may be going on, because he hasn't been able to?
Sure, Janae. You're referring to, you may or may not be referring to, there's another article on our website, whowhatwhy.com, called What Obama is Up Against. And this is principally about the interests that simply will not let an American president withdraw from our state of near constant war. This is just a math equation. The percentage of the federal budget that goes to war making, or whether you want to call it defense or national security or whatever you want to call it, or homeland security, it's so huge, and it's so much bigger percentage-wise than any other country on Earth, and many, many multiples, that, this thing has to be sustained, because the economy, frankly, is totally dependent on it. All kinds of companies would probably collapse if there was any sort of shift away from that. And so they just have to understand that this cannot be done. And, of course, any of those us who are old enough to remember, the peace dividend at the end of the Soviet Union and of communism, it was no longer, it was the end of history. There would no longer be a need for this kind of this kind of militarism, and yet it just never happened. Mm-hmm. And so these guys get into office, and they understand that they can't really change this. And in case they forget, there are these leaks. And one of these leaks was the leak of General McChrystal's memo about what was needed in Afghanistan. That was leaked in the fall. And it basically forced Obama's hand because the Pentagon was able to put out this thing, and then Obama couldn't get out from under it, and so you saw what he did. He ended up basically going along with it and sending these troops into Afghanistan. Now, there's been a recent leak, which is one from Gates, and it's on another subject. But again, it tells the president and it tells the public this is what the decision has been made, basically. And so they're sort of trapped in this thing. And I think one of the reasons they're trapped, again, is just a lack of information on the part of the public. If the public were to understand the reality of this situation, we would begin a kind of a frank discussion where everybody would get involved of how do we begin incrementally moving away from this state of war, and how do we shift to a real peacetime economy? Because all of these companies, those companies that also make, buses and subway systems, things like that, their big money and their big profit centers are in military. And it's not just those companies. We don't realize this, but you look at, I don't care what it is, but almost any company making almost anything, their biggest client is the military, and they've all got to be weaned off of that.
Yeah, I discovered that when I was working for a firm years ago in Cambridge, Abt Associates, and the president of the firm had been working with, I forget who it was at the time, but they received a surge of money from a right-wing organization, and suddenly they were supporting the Vietnam War, and chose my age, and a lot more. The whole climate changed dramatically, and I had to leave.
Yeah.
That was just one example. But I want to ask you who Gates is. Is he involved with the Bushes as well?
Oh, boy. You know, this is another interesting thing. Here is a man who, a career CIA officer, George H.W. Bush, who, as I document in Family of Secrets, had his own secret history with the CIA. In fact, his father's business partner basically created the blueprint for the CIA, a guy named Lovett. So that they were deeply entwined with the CIA. When H.W. Bush becomes president in 1988, he appoints as the CIA director Robert Gates. Gates was CIA director under Bush 41. When he was defeated by Clinton, Gates goes to Texas, where he's made the head of the George H.W. Bush Library, where his papers are. And by the way, I can tell you,
what
having
papers?
Been there, they censored these things massively. They try to take out anything of any possible interest to any researcher.
What papers were you referring to? You just said
You know, the correspondence of Mr. Bush over the years when he was in the oil business and when he was a congressman and a diplomat. They just went through everything. I mean, it's staggering.
It is.
So Robert Gates presided over that. Then he was made the president of the university where the library was. He was put on the board of various companies so that he could be taken care of. And then when the son, George W., became president, after Rumsfeld basically became just untenable, they brought in Robert Gates and they made him the Secretary of Defense. So now we get Obama, who everybody thinks is going to change everything, and what does he do?
Yes.
He keeps Robert Gates in the job.
That really, I was startled. That was the beginning of the end for me.
But, you know, there's been very little discussion in the mainstream media about how remarkable that is in itself. Now, some people say, well, why are you surprised? The U.S. is at war. They need continuity and so on. But, I mean, honestly, that is a very, very telling thing because there are huge numbers of qualified people inside the military, familiar with the military and so forth, who could take that position and who would be looking to really make major changes. But it isn't going to happen, and that's why he's still in there.
So he was one of the key players from the military and intelligence complex.
That's right.
Overseeing what Obama's doing, as there were in Nixon's time.
Well, not only overseeing. I mean, there was a very telling remark buried in a New York Times article. I think it was New York Times or Washington Post, where it said that when Bush was president, Gates was traveling a lot. you know, visiting bases and things, but that under Obama, he stays in Washington mostly because he wants to keep his eye on the White House. He wants to keep his hand in there, and he's always there at meetings and things. Well, that's very telling in itself.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Observing.
Russ, I wanted to look again at the economic, the financial structure, and wonder whether it's enough to just be able to come back against the military. What I've heard is that the Federal Treasury is backed by originally the Rothschilds and then the Morgans and Lehman. If we have basically only borrowed money, how can it ever be undone? You know, without changing the structure of the whole economy, that the power that a state has is to be able to make its own currency. But if what we have is borrowed money and we're continue to pay interest, it just seems like basically the Rothschilds have owned the U.S. since the creation of the Federal Treasury.
I'm not a person who subscribes to that. I think that a lot of that is basically latent anti-Semitism. The reality is, if you study the Rothschilds, they're like any other family. They're much more complicated than that, and their power is hardly monolithic to that extent. The reality, by the way, about Wall Street and a lot of these decisions, and you go on the internet, and there's a tremendous amount where they use these Jewish names, and the Lehmans were Jewish also. But the fact of the matter is, if you look at many of the families that have the most influence in these things, they are these old-line American families that have been here since the beginning of the country. So this stuff is much more complicated. But I would just say this. I don't think it's about a particular family. I don't think it's about the Federal Reserve particularly. I think it's about the whole system benefiting wealth and greed, period. And I think that a lot of people get caught up in particular theories about this and that, and it's gold, and it's, you know, and a lot of the things that I see on the internet, when I start digging into them, they're not true. And I don't think that even those things we hear about the Federal Reserve are quite as simplified as they're made out to be. One of the things we hope to do through Who, What, Why is to begin exploring these things from the standpoint of saying we don't know.
Right.
And we don't go in with any agenda or any prejudices, but we're going to try to look at these things and sort them out as best as we can.
So you might be doing that in the future, looking at those questions, because I just...
Well, we very much are, but you see, the way we do it is we stay close to the ground. So this article that people will find on Who, What, Why about UBS Bank, we just start looking at UBS, and we start looking at the decisions they made, the connections, the appointments they get, and we just start, you know, because we don't want to lose people. We don't want to overwhelm them with too much stuff, so we're just starting to poke around at visible things. The president golfing with this guy heading a company that's involved with massive tax evasion. Then Obama, by the way, appoints this man to an economic advisory council. That's interesting. That's factual material. That's how we're going about this, step by step.
I'm curious, are you looking for interns? I love what you're doing.
Well, you know, we are looking for all kinds of people to be involved. I mean, one of the problems is that this work is extremely painstaking, and it's very, very hard for us to find people who have, you know, it's kind of like, you know, microsurgery or something. We can't
you have
even
to be
use
patient.
We can't even just use anybody who graduated from a good medical school. That's the analogy there. We need that handful that are really you know, that we can work with, who are easy to work with, who are open-minded, who have the exact right skill set. So, but we can use other people in all kinds of things. So if there are people out there who are trained in particular areas or want to just go out and help, you know, a lot of what people are doing is they're say, setting up things like a tour. So they'll say, we want you to come to, for example, Santa Cruz, come out, do a signing and a reading from Family of Secrets, then maybe a talk at the university there and so on. And anybody, you know, can do that. So we'd love to hear from people.
It.
They can go to our website, whowhatwhy.com, and click where it says to send us mail and tell us, you know, their idea of how they'd like to help.
Yeah.
There's lots of different ways.
Because you really do have that determination to unearth the facts, and it does take a lot of discipline and patience.
Well, that's what we're about. So, yeah. And we like it. We enjoy what we're doing. And the other thing is we stay positive. I think we're happy people. We enjoy life. And we think that this is part of an enjoyable, fulfilling life, to look into the world in which we live and to unearth the mysteries, try to solve them, and make a better place for everybody.
Yeah, and thank you for all the work that you are doing. You're doing it for those of us that don't have the inclination or the time or the patience. And I want to thank you so much again, Russ, for coming on. And let's go over your websites once more.
Okay. For the book, which is called Family of Secrets,
yes,
the website, not surprisingly, is familyofsecrets.com.
Yes.
For the nonprofit investigative news site, the website is www.whowhatwhy.com. As I say, we're just kind of getting started, looking for public support so we can grow and hire up a staff and use talented freelancers. And there's also a personal side of mine, which I really unfortunately don't update much. It's RussBaker.com. But if you poke around there, you can read some of the articles I've written over the last several decades.
Great. And it's there, the website, Who, What, Why, is sort of a continuation of your book.
It really
just
is.
Just branching out because it needs a sequel. People want to continue with it. It's amazing. Thriller. Well, thank you so much again, and I'm probably going to have you on. I have a lot of questions about what's going on, and you're the one I look to for the answers.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. Okay. Bye-bye. Well, that was Russ Baker, author of Family of Secrets, and we're going to have Gabriel Day on shortly, and he's going to be talking about the understanding.
Please enter the number you wish to dial.
Pardon me. Now we're going to listen to Humanity's Police. Stay with us.
Oh, it's a mystery to me. We have agreed, with which we have agreed. Think you have to want more than you need. Until you have it all, you won't be free. Society, you're a crazy breed. I hope you're not lonely without me. Want more than you have, you think you need. And when you think more than you want, your thoughts begin to bleed. I think I need to find a bigger place. 'Cause when you have more than you think, you need more space.
Because I'm a human being, you see. Maybe he'll do that in a moment, but not my full name, just my first name. And he just said straight away, have you got a permit to do this? To which I will respond, sir, do you have a permit to do what you are doing?
I appreciate you want to express your views and everything.
He appreciates I want to express my views and everything.
Look. I'm trying to be nice here, fella.
He is trying to be nice here, and all I'm doing is repeating what you're saying on the megaphone. I'm not changing a word that you're saying. You are trying to be nice, and that's fine. I'm also trying to be nice. So let me just first explain something very important to you. One of the things I do is I'm actually the instigator and leader of a group called the Police Hugging Department. And what we do is give police hugs. So what I'm going to do is give you a hug to start with.
Alright,
all I'm going to do is to repeat so everyone can hear the conversation. That's
let
all
let
I'm
him talk, yeah.
Hiya. Alright, look guys, please stop with the megaphone, right? I've appreciated your expressing your views or whatever you're doing. Do you have a permit from the railways? Are you allowed to be here?
Unfortunately, we don't need a permit to be this. This is not actually the railway property.
It is actually.
No, it's not actually. This is not
permit
over here.
It's
not a railway property.
It is, unfortunately.
I've done some research on this. If you can show me a map of the railway property, I'd appreciate it.
How about we go and talk about it, and then we can...
Sorry?
If we go and do it in the office...
No, I'm not talking in the office. but I don't want to go to your office. You can come to my office if you like.
This is the railway.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, this gentleman who has been very nice to me told me that I can need a permit to do this because it's railway property. Interesting. So therefore, I am now standing off the steps and I am no longer on railway property.
Okay, enough of that. Now we have Jason King on the line, and he is one of the co-sponsors of Understanding Deep Politics. It's going to be a conference in Santa Cruz from May 14th through the 16th, and it's about the driving forces behind world events. And his buddy's calling in right now, so one moment. Teresa's going to talk to you a little bit about this upcoming conference.
This is Teresa Caraggio, and...
hi, are you with us?
Is discover the
oh, hi, Gabriel. Okay. I think I have you both on now.
In one packed weekend, bringing together speakers and concerned citizens. It's something I'm very excited about.
We could have one if you want, but
a topic
we can
that,
talk about a bit too.
That we all need to understand, and it's a good segue from just talking to Russ Baker.
Hi, now we have Gabriel Day and Jason King, both the sponsors of Understanding Deep Politics, that conference. Let's see if they're both on with us. Are you with us, guys?
Jason's here.
Jason, great. And Gabriel, are you online?
Yes.
Oh, great. Let me turn you up a little bit. Oh, thank you for coming on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. Oops. One of you sounds very high-pitched. I think it's Gabriel. Hi. Gabriel?
Yes.
There. Are you on a cell phone?
No, I'm on a landline.
Huh. It just sounds kind of high-pitched. Anyway, we can adjust to it. Great. Well, we're excited about the conference. As soon as I heard about it, I went online to find out who was responsible for bringing it to town, and looks like you two were.
Well, actually, there's four of us, Cindy.
Oh, who are the other two?
The other two are Kevin Zenzi, San Francisco Bay Area, and Cheryl Curtis out of Hartford, Connecticut.
Great.
Four of us on the volunteer organizing committee.
Oh, are they also on the line?
No.
Oh, it's just great. It's the two of you. You wouldn't have room for them to get a speakerphone. We only have two lines here. But what gave you the idea to have the conference? Is this an annual conference? This is the first I've heard of it, but... either one of you can answer, Gabriel.
Well, Cindy, is there a way that I can hear Jason? Because I can't hear if Jason.
Oh, you can't.
Oh,
darn. You could go online and listen to us. Go to Free Radio Santa Cruz and click on listen.
Okay.
And then from
but
there.
Until then, could you just, like, either direct a question to Jason or I so we can know which one of us to respond?
Yes, I will. So, Jason, how did you come up with the idea, or how did this all come together?
Well, it was really a long process because we started thinking about organizing a conference. It was probably a year and a half ago, and we were looking at, both Gabriel and I have worked on different conferences over the past couple of years. I organized one in Boston in 2006 and 2007. Gabriel organized one in Chicago in 2005, and a media conference that was in Santa Cruz, I think in 07 or 08, Gabriel also did. So we had worked on different conferences with different themes. Often it was either related to 9/11 truth, or it was related to alternative media, genres of that sort. And so I think out of our combined experience of organizing different conferences, we were looking for a new theme. And originally we thought we would do a collaborative conference with activists in Europe. And we were looking at holding a simultaneous event, one in Chicago and one in Berlin, with activists we know in Europe. Andy Michon, who's the principal activist we were working with, and she's on our speakers list for the current conference. At any rate, we went through a lot of obstacles, putting together names of people, developing our concept. Finally, what happened was Andy went on to organize her conference, which ended up in Paris, And we decided to wait on ours until our ideas were a little more firmly developed. Eventually, you might say that we came to, it's when you're putting together a conference, it's always a melding. It's a melding of who's available to be the participants, the speakers and the presenters, and what is your personal thinking? What is the message you want to drive, and how do you want to use these speakers to, mm-hmm. to help you convey the issues, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So
yes.
You kind of meet each other halfway in the middle because you don't always have the resources you want, and your concept has to mesh nicely with the type of people you'll bring in, right?
Yes, for sure.
So it was kind of like a, it really took a while to mesh all these talents together. And finally we realized we had this kind of a lineup, and the principal, what I would say is the headliner here is Peter Dale Scott, who's a scholar and activist who developed the term deep politics. So what our politics, what was driving us as activists was that, we want to try to get people to understand the deep underpinnings of the political structures that we're working with, because given the nature of the issues we've been working on, which Dave and I have done a lot of work on 9/11, mm-hmm. is that we realize how deceived we are,
mm-hmm.
and how there is just a vast underpinning of what you might say covert structures that run our economy, run our government.
Yes.
Run our media.
It's
interesting. We just had Russ Baker on. I listened to about half of that, and I agree with everything he said.
Oh, he was brilliant. This is wonderful.
Yeah,
that you're putting this together with who you have.
I'm looking at the website right now, and one, it's just beautiful. The way that it's laid out and the graphics, it's just so nicely done. But also, I just can't believe the lineup of speakers that you have.
I know
and
it.
I know. One of them
you
is a
guys have
hitter,
done your work.
And if I could have named
That's
a list
exciting.
Of the people who I have been wanting to see desperately coming to my own town that would be on your list. Could you talk about, maybe Gabriel, talk about some of the other speakers who are coming? Gabriel?
I think we lost him.
No, I'm here, but Cindy, I can barely hear someone else speaking.
Oh, I wanted to know about more about the other speakers who are coming.
Okay, well, I'm sorry to say I haven't been able to hear what Jason said because I've been trying to tune into the radio station online.
Oh, we can have Jason address it then.
Well, I don't know which one's the 10th.
Right, I think he talked about Annie Machan and
yes.
Peter Dale.
Peter Dale, who coined the phrase deep democracy. So, Jason, do you want to answer the question?
I'm sorry.
It's all right.
Yes. Right. So, we initially started working with Annie Machan as an organizer, not necessarily just a presenter, but we wanted to bring her in as a presenter.
Mm-hmm.
So, as we were lining up people that we felt that could work with the theme we were developing, I mean, really, this took a year. This took a year and hundreds of hours of volunteer time.
Oh, I can imagine. Sure, I would think it would take longer.
So that's, that's why it's remarkable. It's remarkable in terms of the lineup because it's all the time that went into it. But in terms of our other speakers, we've got Ian Crane coming, who you may not know as well. He's from the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Ellen Brown, Jim Morris from Texas, Cynthia McKinney, I'm sure mm-hmm. you're familiar with her, Michael
yes.
Parente,
yes.
Peter Phillips, and Peter Dale, and Barry Zwicker, who's a Canadian journalist. Let me see here. So, with Ellen Brown, you may be familiar with her book, Web of Debt, where she really gets into the underpinnings
mm-hmm.
Of our economy and what you might call the sort of false nature of it.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's a topic that I'm especially interested in.
I know.
I think that's going to be fascinating.
I do too.
Yeah.
To read her book.
She brings in the economic analysis, which is really great to have another angle on it. And, Ian Crane is from the UK. He's a really interesting guy. I guess he used to be an oil executive one time, and now he's just full out activist on all kinds of issues. Human rights. He understands the deep state, 9/11, all these things. Busting big pharma. That's my on his address.
Having David Ray Griffin and having Barry Zwicker in the same place will be fabulous. Looking at the false flag operations and putting that together will be so interesting.
And are they going to be speaking at different times so we don't have to make a decision as to who we're going to listen to?
You can check the schedule on the website. Each person has their own spot for presenting on their own. Mm-hmm. And then on the weekend at the culmination, there's a speaker's panel. There'll be two panels at the end of the day on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll be grouped differently in two separate panels at that point.
Is there anything that you have planned for discussion or for small group participation or somewhere for this to go afterwards?
Well, we haven't put that in. And there have been a couple requests for doing something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, well, it's not entirely organized at this point, but what we do have is we have a resource room, and we're going to have various tables set up with sort of themes at each table for discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So you might say it's a bit self-organized. People will be able to go in there and sit down and start up conversations with each other, sort of with these tables set up as a way to get it going.
I've seen so many things that have been really inspiring, but then everyone goes home.
I know.
Well, it's our responsibility to keep it going.
Right,
that's
but to have a venue for that.
Yes.
To have some kind of organizing venue to make use of that information.
Maybe we can work on that before you arrive. And get that started. What happened to Gabriel? Gabriel, are you still with us?
I'm here.
Oh, there you are.
I can hear Jason speaking, but there's a delay between you and I talking, and then I hear him talking to some other woman, and I'm not sure who's the other party.
Oh, there are two of us here. My co-host, Teresa Caraggio.
Hi, Gabriel.
Myself, Cindy Janea, and Teresa are here, so there are four of us.
Got it.
What would you like to say about some of the speakers and how you chose them and why, Gabriel?
Well, I very much would appeal to everybody who's listening to come on down if they can, because we have a great lineup. This has been almost 18 months of work by us, brainstorming on who we could pull together to address all of this, and also who we think could be collaborate with on coming up with a creative solution, because we got a lot of feedback from that they just didn't want another conference to go over how dark it was out there.
We're having a hard time hearing you. I have you on full.
You know what? Would that mean to call back on another line?
Maybe you can call back again on this line, but I don't understand why we can barely hear you.
Okay, well, I'll try. Can we call back on the same number?
Sure. And I'll see what happens.
You know, Michael Parenti is a friend of Free Radio Santa Cruz. A little over a year ago, he came and did a fundraiser for us and gave a talk, and we had a dinner ahead of time that was just, it was tremendous.
Well, that's great.
Yeah, I'm a real follower of his books. I've been working on something, I mentioned it in the last show, called the Universe City, CITY, to be an alternative form of higher education. So that we can take, I mean, I look at every speaker that you have here, and I say, you know, there should be a class designed around this.
I know.
Yeah.
We should have a group of students so that the students can not only learn the truth, but so they can add on to it, so that they can become researchers who are adding their voices and their firsthand investigations to the body of knowledge that we have here.
Yeah. Excellent idea.
It seems like we need something like that.
Yeah. I remember Russ Baker saying that, you know, this sort of body of knowledge doesn't really get into our traditional educational system.
Okay, Gabriel.
Exactly.
Did you try another phone?
I did.
There. It still sounds a little tinny, but it's better. It's a definite improvement. Hi. Well, we're talking about the lineup of speakers again, and I'm curious as to why you chose who you chose specifically. Let's look at.
Jim Mars is someone hasn't been talked about yet.
I know.
I'm interested in knowing more about him.
That's exactly what I was going to zero in on. I don't even see him on mine. Can you say a little bit about Jim Mars?
Jim Mars probably, he's been around for a long time as a journalist. He's written a number of books. His last book is on the between Nazis and the Bush family. So we can call it Rise of the Fourth Reich. But prior to that, he wrote quite a book on the JFK assassination.
Hmm.
And of course, he's been very early on. He was out on 9/11 truth issues at an all-major conference for that back in 2004 and 2005.
What were the books that he wrote once more? Jim Mars.
Jim Mars. Let me just.
Did he write? The Rise of the Fourth Reich.
Right, Rise of the Fourth Reich.
Yes.
I'm trying to remember. 9/11 book was.
I see it here. And then there's Rule by Secrecy. And Crossfire, which served as the basis for Oliver Stone's movie JFK. And it says on your website that he's going to discuss the continuation of the National Socialist ideals from their beginnings in the 1930s, following the thread all the way up to the modern day society. Great. What a lineup.
And Peter Phillips is also someone that we haven't talked about yet. Can you give a little information about him?
Gabriel?
Yes.
Hi. Do you want to share a little bit about Peter Phillips?
Well, Peter Phillips was the director of Project Sunset up until recently. Now he's with a new organization, the New Media Foundation. And he's going to kick off on Friday night along with Steve McKinney.
Great.
And do an overview.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to repeat that. You're still kind of hard to hear. And I'm looking at your website. He's the president of the Media Freedom Foundation Project, censored for over 18 years. And he's going to kick off with Cynthia McKinney.
Friday night,
great. What is the lineup? What does the schedule look like for people on Friday night and then... Who's speaking Saturday and Sunday?
Okay, well, starting at 5 o'clock, we have a little social hour in one of the rooms at the UC Conference Center. It goes from 5 to 6:30.
Mm-hmm.
And then at 6:30, we open doors up for the evening presentations. And then it starts off with our MC, which will be Kevin Smith out of Austin, Texas. And then we go in following with Cindy McKinney and Peter Phillips. And we're trying to leave end by 10 so that people really can get out and socialize and get each other.
Could you speak up just a little? I don't know why we're having such difficulty.
Sure. Does this sound better now?
Yes, it is. Great. Thank you.
Okay.
Now, would you mind saying once more? Unfortunately, we just couldn't hear you very well about the lineup on Friday night.
Sure.
Okay.
I'll just go over that again quickly.
Thanks.
Well, we have registration starting at 3 in the lobby, and then we go into a social hour, this little meet and greet starting at 5, going on for an hour and a half. And then we go into the main rooms for the evening presentation with Cindy McKinney and Peter Phillips.
Great.
And again, for the details, this is at the UCSC, the University Inn, mm-hmm. on Ocean Street. And do you want to talk about prices and how someone signs up? Jason, do you want to mention that?
Sure. Well, right now, there's two ways to do it. You can go on our website, and you can find the link to buy tickets from the website at understandingdeeppolitics.org, or you can just come to the door and pay by cash or check at the door itself.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a number of options. there's a weekend pass, there's just a day pass, or if you just want to come in the evening, mm-hmm. The range is like from $25 to $110 for the whole deal.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the current information. Of course, if you yeah, I got it right in front of me. So we have like a weekend pass for $110. Got discounts for students and seniors.
Mm-hmm.
For $85, we got an all-day pass, which is like just $60 for a day, or just a Friday night pass or a Saturday night pass, which is like $25 for the evening. If you just wanted to hear the highlight in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And for all those speakers, it seems so worth
that is,
it.
That is.
It's just a wonderful thing to have this event and get so much going on all in the same place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes, and I think it'll be great for the folks who can do the entire weekend because when it culminates on Sunday, when we have our two panels, to see all of those speakers brainstorming together is going to be quite exciting.
Yes, it will.
And just the ideas, my experience is the ideas that are generated and the relationships that are formed during the mm-hmm. course of something like this can create whole other worlds.
And so many of us are very frustrated right now by what's going on and
right.
the paradigm that we're living under. And this is a real chance to come together and begin to shift that and not reinvent the wheel. Look at what we're doing. Come together and
yeah.
brainstorm and then start taking action.
Right.
And see where you may want to fit into something that you don't know about.
I noticed that Ellen Brown mentions that she's going to focus on some solutions. Will that be a part of the ending seminars, do you think?
For sure. We've asked all of our speakers to spend, a good amount of their time
mm-hmm.
not only presenting the problems at hand, which, some are more aware of than others, but also to offer solutions.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that'll figure prominently
Great.
Into our panel discussion.
That's so important now more than ever.
And I especially like that you don't have people who just jump on bandwagons, because there's so much of that, coalition building by finding a common enemy.
Yeah.
Right.
Whereas you have people who are all looking at how do we understand the system itself
yeah.
and what
right.
changes from that direction.
Russell?
Yes. Certainly that is the theme, is understanding.
Yes.
understanding what's before us.
Now, what were you looking for in each speaker? When we started talking, you said that you wanted to look at their message and what you wanted to convey and who was best able to convey that message.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can you go into, but either, I guess I can start with Gabriel. What were you looking for?
Well, of course, it actually boiled down, of course, the people that we were able to get a hold of. Course, when you start brainstorming a conference, you might even put twice as many names up. But then we were working on, okay, what are the subject areas we want to cover to educate people about? So it kind of boiled down to these 10, and that were available all for this one weekend, of course, with people, it's very challenging.
That's hard, too.
We thought maybe you could have just Googled conspiracy theorist and the first 10 names that came up.
Yes.
Can we fit you in here?
Something that I've been really interested in is semantics and how the terminology gets turned against us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just phrases like that, conspiracy theorist and mm. democracy, without being defined, they end up getting used as double-edged swords, where they can be as easily used against you as for the right side.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That certainly is true, and I think that the problem with that is we need people who are deeper thinkers
mm-hmm.
who just don't accept those surface solutions that I presented you to
mm-hmm.
you by the people who want to manipulate you.
Right, yeah.
Exactly. They have a hidden agenda.
And that's certainly what these people do in this lineup that we have. I recall your previous show, Les Baker was saying, well, what can we do? Mm-hmm. You know, he was saying people need to read a lot. People need to understand what's going on. They need to wake up to the reality that they're living in, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, he was.
And that's what all of these people are doing. They're unearthing information that is not popular. That's definitely suppressed. And they're presenting it. They're bringing it forward. And so, to me, that's what's being achieved here with this kind of a lineup. And then just the fact that there are so many more journalists and writers and researchers, I think, that are coming forward with this kind of a body of work.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's just because we have the internet now or because people are seeing things for what they are, whatever it is, to me, you know.
Or the situations have become so dire. It's a wake-up call for many.
So, to me, that's like the mission. You know, getting people's awareness onto this level of research and knowledge, I think, is really critical.
Right. I've been listening a lot to John Taylor Gatto, the author of Dumbing Us Down.
And sure.
So that idea that education is really the place to start so that we can get that deep knowledge to be able to diagnose the problem before we can really, you know, that activism, I think, is beside the point. It's not the time for activism. Before that, we have to start with some kind of strategy, and for a workable strategy, you first have to understand what the problem is.
Mm-hmm.
But there are activists that do, and then to take action once you have the information or the veil is lifted. To continue to take action, which you are doing. I would call you an activist, Teresa. You're doing something to change the paradigm that we're living under.
Don't find, though, that activists have good strategy together. I mean, in a recent coalition, I brought up the question of whether countries have the right of self-defense. Do people have the right of self-defense? And that's very controversial. You know, they won't touch it. So I don't think that we, as you know, who think of ourselves as on the same side, have a common ideology, have a sense of being, even have a common vocabulary.
That's
be able to
a
talk
good point.
About these issues.
It's coming to terms with what our terms are, understanding them, and really taking the time to deep listening is so important. What is someone really saying, and if are you going to really hear it? And that's what Russ was saying, too. He goes in with a clean slate into whatever he's looking at. And it is important. I mean, I have to constantly check myself. What's my hidden agenda? Where is it? It's going to reveal itself if I'm having a lot of angst in a discussion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think that being able to define our terms, and one thing that Gatto talks about is training kids, really everyone, in how to do critical thinking, how to be able to write persuasively, and also how to use public discourse in a way that moves things forward rather than getting stuck in kind of false paradigms.
I'll have to read it. Ethics. It's essential.
Yeah. Now, he wrote The Dumbing Down of America, I think, and I've heard some of his lectures. He would fit nicely on a lineup like ours.
I was just going to say, what happened to him? And I understand you tried to get Russ Baker on, but I guess he was doing something else.
Our timing didn't work out too well. Russ would have been a nice addition.
Yep. Fortunately, there are more than 10 great speakers who are dealing with these issues.
I know.
Right.
Oh, I know. It was bleak for a while. Gabriel, are you still there?
Yes, I want to say that we've had, of course, a lot of input of people saying what we should do in deep politics, too, you know, like a second round of this. We're talking with Lenny Charles from INN World Report out of New York City, wants us to bring this to the East Coast in the fall with another lineup. Because, of course, there's some other kind of dimensions of deep politics we haven't even addressed, like the hoax of the war on drugs, you know.
Yes, the hunt.
Right.
And
I know you really
people
did.
People mentioned chemtrails too, you know.
Yes. And GMOs and sustainable
agriculture. Related to our attack on our health, you know.
And the economics of money and what money really is. We had John Bloom on, the genius of money, a few weeks ago, and we really began to look at our relationship to money, not just the debt and interest, but how we interact with it, our identity with money. He's someone.
I think also the conspiracies in Latin America and being able to look at our foreign policy.
Definitely.
And all the subterfuge that's going on there. There are a number of speakers that would be really wonderful for the next one.
It's limitless, but what you have coming up is so exciting. That in and of itself, I'm just really impressed. And Michael Parenti was one of our guests. At our fundraiser, he spoke. He was our mover and shaker that year, 2 years ago.
What is
this is kind of a follow-up to the conference that happened in Santa Cruz at the same location in January of 2008. It was the Truth Emergency there, publicizing truth with consequences.
Ah. I wasn't aware of that. How could I have missed it?
It did happen there. It was a great event. We had a lot of the same characters. We had Cynthia, Peter Dale Scott, David Ray Griffin, Peter Phillips. But it was more like an independent media fest.
Oh, I do remember hearing about that. I was out of town, yes.
Yeah, so we've got a lot of the same, kind of the same people in the background that helped us putting on that one. Our back, we've got David Kubiak, who's been one of our international advisors, is flying in from Japan to join us.
Mm-hmm.
He was basically the lead organizer on that last one in January.
So in this one, you've chosen to open it up to the public more, not just make it a media event.
Right, yeah.
Great.
I'm very proud that it can happen in Santa Cruz.
Yes, I know it. It's ripe. It really is. And for those of you that are just tuning in, we're speaking with Gabriel Day and Jason Scott, and they created a conference entitled Understanding Deep Politics. And it's revealing the driving forces behind world events and creative alternative solutions. It's going to be held between May 14th, Friday, through the 16th at the University Inn and Conference Center. And your website is just understandingdeeppolitics.org.
Yes.
And there's a lot of information on there and how to register and a review of all of the speakers and panelists.
How is the turnout looking? If someone comes to the door on Friday to get a pass, is there any likelihood that you'll be sold out, or will that be possible?
It would be nice if we were, but unfortunate for the person coming to the door. But no, I think we'll be just fine.
Jason, taking that, or you want me to take that?
You take it, Gabe. I don't think you can hear me.
Gabriel, you take it.
Our advanced ticket sales are fairly good, but right now I would say we probably will have space for people.
Good. There'll be that flexibility. If someone is just learning about it, they can attend or they can't attend all of them, or for whatever reason couldn't get an advanced ticket.
Right. It'll be a good mix of people. We definitely have got people coming out from Florida, New England, Colorado, Southern California. We've done some outreach to people down there with KPF. Of course.
Yes.
Other networks.
So you've been doing a lot of outreach.
We consider this a national level conference.
It is.
We went public, I think, February 1st, as soon as we could, to really alert people all across America and the world to come join us.
Someone was speaking, I don't know who it was, one of your guests, on a coast-to-coast show, and the next morning a friend of mine called from Boston and said, there's going to be this deep politics conference in Santa Cruz, and I said, I don't think so. I would have heard about it. For some reason, I didn't hear about it. I said, no, someone was just talking about it on this late-night show, and he's going to be on, and she couldn't remember who it was. I don't know which guest it was, but that's how I heard about it. So then I went online and emailed you too. We have to get the word out more.
We always learn the lessons from every conference we put on of things we can do better. But, of course, being a volunteer effort, we're not professional paid people that are doing this. This is
been a labor of love of us and many other people that helped us out with it. So.
Oh, and I want to thank you for it. We're getting the benefits of it. You'll have to volunteer the next time.
And it's still not too late. If people can go to our website, and if you go under conference details and you go to announcements, there's an email announcement they can cut and paste right there and send it out to their list of friends and anybody that might be interested in coming to join us.
Well, I just signed up for my ticket just now.
She's online with her computer right here.
After looking at this, I don't want to risk you being sold out, just in case this broadcast brings in a whole new group of people.
Thank you.
As you say, it's unprecedented and truly provocative, and that it is. And it's sad that it has to be provocative. I mean, this should just, well, ideally, if we lived in an ideal world, we'd be able to delve into these conversations freely.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Right, and if most of the mainstream journalists were truly journalists, and trying to keep our government transparent for the people and being an independent view on things and not be so corporate-dominated that they won't address these deeper underlying truths of our world.
I know. And I imagine that some journalists, though, do feel stuck and stymied when they realized how little they can truly write about or speak about.
Right.
Because they get the information. Just get edited from above, right?
Yes.
And I've heard it referred to as the 3-foot leash.
The 3-foot leash?
I think one, you get the 3 feet.
I was excited about the opportunity to network with the kind of people who will be coming to this conference. To me, the audience is always as much of a draw as the speakers.
Absolutely. I mean, the people that would be attracted to it in the first place and sharing their ideas and their visions, and everyone is just going to be hopping with ideas and, in the university.
Absolutely. I mean, I've done these things for quite a while now. 2005 work on organizing conferences, and I always get the most pleasure out of seeing the friendships and the bonds between people that are created at physical events, because I think if we're just all talking on the phone and on the internet, we just don't get that human dimension of the face-to-face camaraderie and the kind of esprit de corps between people of, like, we all know these deeper truths, we want to try to educate ourselves more about these things, and how do we take action turn around the course of our world.
Right. I think there's a critical need to have that solidarity and to recognize that you're not alone, especially in things like this, where there's so much skepticism and there's so much resistance, where for a long time I've looked at it and I said, this is so obvious. It's just, it's in front of their face. Why can't they see it? And so to be asking that question in a serious way, and say, well, why can't they see it? Let's examine what those obstacles are so that we can work out a strategy to get around them.
And we're going to be looking at it from so many angles at the conference. You really have. It's impressive. The economic perspective, the philosophical.
Another angle, though, that I'd love to see in understanding deep politics, too, is religion. Is that a lot of my research on my website, just to give a plug, is thirdparadigm.org. You can spell it either way. And if you go to the sections that has the different titles for all the past episodes, there's a section on religion. And in one of them, I tried to get Michael Parenti, who has done so much work, on the assassination of Julius Caesar. And I've done similar work on the same era, but looking at a people's history of the Bible and what was really happening, and whether the Bible itself, as I believe it is a Roman conspiracy. There's a lot of background to this, and some other speakers that I could recommend for the next time, because that's where the roots of this control system go back to. It's been 2,000 years where we've been operating under the kind of illusion that takes our best, noblest impulses and turns them to empowering exactly the wrong people.
It's true.
you know, this seems to be kind of the nature of power, no matter what century you're in, to basically manipulate and marshal the forces of social policy and thought.
Is he still with us?
Yes.
Yep. Okay, good. Haven't heard him in a while.
Oh, there he is. Continue, Jason.
Oh, so, yeah, just to you know, I think this is just what you were thinking of.
I want to say my appreciation to Jason. All of you looking at our website, that was Jason's creation. He's done a wonderful job.
Oh, he certainly has. He was just sharing.
Yeah, I don't think you can hear each other.
No.
Sorry.
That's all right. You were speaking about social politics, pretty much.
Right, just that, you know, our speakers address this in the more contemporary term. You know, just the issue we're just speaking about, Parenti's subject of the assassination of Caesar and the Roman manipulation of society to create sort of like a their world religion, which became Christianity, as a means of control of their own. I think some of my reading about that was basically the emperor was rather upset that all his troops were at war with each other over which sect of God they were worshiping, and he wanted to get them all under one banner. So I don't know what it, you know, I don't know more than that, but
that's
all I'm
hear.
Saying is there's always a power play at hand in terms of manipulating the society you're living in here for not necessarily for our benefit, but for the benefit of
those that are ruling.
Yeah, our ruling class here. So it's true in it's true in ancient Rome, and it's true here today.
Right. I won't go into the details, but the real story makes the zeitgeist explanation look way too benign.
Oh dear!
It is the most sinister thing you will ever hear. Once you look at the actual details of it. Check out the website.
Oh, yeah, that's her third paradigm. And if you want to hear, I don't have a website, but I'm going to put a plug in for Radio for All. And if you want to go to Radio for All, you can listen to this program and other Tickling the Belly of the Beast programs. And then on the upper right-hand corner, type in Tickling the Belly of the Beast. And that's Radio for All, the number 4. So, and I will send a link to you guys afterwards.
Thank you.
Sure.
Have you been at all connected to the people who put on the Deep Democracy conferences? It seems like it would be an interesting segue, because what they look at is the historical. It's David Cobb of Democracy Unlimited, Humboldt County. There's another organization that they involve a number of different groups who are looking at how the Constitution got written. And one of my segments is also
what about
called
the Bill of Rights?
Right, is called "Was the Constitution an Act of Treason?" And looks at the history of that and whether it was a fast one that got pulled over on the people and imposed through through a coalition of what are the prototypes of transnational corporations. So looking at the history, I mean, you're looking a lot at what's happening right now. And so was Russ Baker. But I think there's a need to put that together with the Howard
Zinn. Give us a historical context.
Right, research. And and be able to take those two pieces and say, how did we get here, in order to really figure out how we can change it.
So that we're not reinventing history.
Right. Yeah, very interesting. Maybe that could be Deep Politics 2 or 3.
you need
sure
help. You too. Yeah.
Gabriel's very familiar with David Cobb, and he could speak a little more to that. I think he must be pretty on top of the Deep Democracy bit.
Gabriel, do you want to share what you know about David Cobb and Deep Democracy?
Well, I did live up in Humboldt County for 18 years, and I'm often back up here where I'm actually up here right now, and they're very active in the local community as far as there's a pancake breakfast they have like once a month over at this community house, and very much working on the local politics here. And, of course, corporate personhood, which, of course, is got so much exposure with the unbelievable Supreme Court ruling. You know?
Oh, you know what? It somehow it didn't surprise me, given our climate and our founding fathers, what they actually were. We were founded on a corporation of sorts, I'm learning.
Yes, corporations were created in the 15th century to fund the exploration of the New World.
Yes. And we are led to believe otherwise. The deceptions that Russ spoke about that he has unearthed go very deep. You ought to bring David Cobb down with you.
We
for
could.
The conference.
But he really only tries to, he has a commitment, I think, to stay home 3 weeks of the month.
Pancake breakfast.
One week a month.
Who's that agreement with? His wife?
His wife. She can come down. You can bring the family and we can have a pancake breakfast. We have a Denny's here.
That'd be great.
We could do better than that, though. We could have a neighborhood pancake breakfast and get started.
Yeah.
Oh.
This is just the most terrific start, you know, to this conversation. I think that a lot is going to really come of it. Having that many people who are not taking a superficial view, but who are educating about how all the dots connect together.
You really did your homework and research. Do you stay in touch with these individuals regularly, or how did you know many of them beforehand? Or
yes, let me take that for just a brief. I can tell you about the people I basically know.
Sure.
I mean, I've known Griffin since 2005. He came to our conference out at American University, the first one I really worked on. And then I've had the opportunity to go over to London a few times and met with Annie Michon over there. And I sponsored a California tour for her. And then Ian Crane I met in 2006 in Chicago. We brought him out to a 9/11 Truth Conference.
Oh, could you speak up a bit more again? You're fading.
Sure.
There.
And then Jim's come to other conferences of ours, and of course Cynthia was there.
That's James Mars.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then of course Parente, Phillips, and Peter Dale Scott are all just Bay Area people here that were easy for us to access and very enthusiastically joined in.
Mm-hmm.
Of course,
yes.
We consulted with Peter Dale Scott from the very beginning.
Yes.
Honoring his work in this process. And Barry, we've been friends with since 2004 at the early 9/11 Truth Conferences we've all been involved in.
And what about Cynthia? How did you bring her in?
Well, I just had contact with her. I helped Annie Michon put on an event in Paris called Towards the Truth that happened on February, and we got in touch with Annie to talk to Cynthia over there, and got her commitment to join us. And, she very much enjoyed her last visit to Santa Cruz. In fact, I took her to the Saturn Cafe late at night after one of the nights, but she loved Santa Cruz.
Oh, you know, I just had a thought. The conference is starting on the 14th. If you'd like, I could reserve some slots for you and any of the guests that are available to come in and share on the program the day before, if you have the time, or I'm not sure what's going to be going on for you on
Thursday?
That day. Yes.
Sure.
And
then
I can talk to some. Yes, and I can talk with some
Andy's
of the other
people. Coming in Wednesday,
okay.
And Ian Crane's coming in Thursday. I think Ellen Brown's coming in Wednesday.
Great.
Barry's workers coming in Wednesday.
All right. Well, if they, I'll email you and see what we can arrange, and they can speak, and then there are two others that come on right after me, two other programmers, and I can talk with them as well. We can work around schedules.
Sure.
Wonderful. Okay. We will do that. All right, we're going to have to end now. We have Palestinian news coming on, and then free speech, which is what we're here for.
Thanks so much for letting us come on and
you guys
share about the conference with everyone.
Yep.
And I want to thank you for putting all of this together and the years of work that you've done with other conferences. And we're reaping the benefits of it. I'm really excited.
And I'm looking forward to meeting both of you and yeah. being at this conference.
Oh, yes.
It's going to be tremendous.
It certainly is. Yeah. Revealing.
Thank you both very much. We really appreciate it. And I look forward to meeting both of you in Santa Cruz.
Thank you. And having you on live. When yeah. you get here, we'll talk about sure. that as well. So, thank you so much. Okay, we've been speaking with Gabriel Day and Jason, his last name? I forget his last name, King, about their upcoming conference, Understanding Deep Politics, revealing the driving forces behind world events and creating alternative solutions. That's going to be on May 14th here in Santa Cruz at the University Inn and Conference Center. And we hope to have some of their speakers on here as well on Tickling the Belly of the Beast and hopefully the other shows. But right now I'm going to play, where is it here? One of my favorite songs by Lal, and then we'll have Palestinian news. Thank you for listening. And where is Lal? It's not coming on. Maybe we'll have to put on Palestinian news first. But I want to hear this. It's kind of slow, folks, and it's not my lack of technical knowledge. Here we go. Thank you for listening.
हूँ मलाले सफर की बात सुनो